Doctor. Every afternoon this week at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is real heartwarming comfort food.
What a good way to eat beans.
On FM and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday the 26th of January. This is Today with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning. The headlines today. President Trump has said his administration is reviewing everything connected to the killing of a US citizen in Minneapolis by federal immigration agents, the second this month. More protests have been taking place overnight. We'll be hearing from local politicians about the impact on the community.
The killing of our residents by ICE has put Minneapolis into a crisis mode. Renee Good and Alex should be alive today.
And the Prime Minister is facing a backlash from some Labour MPs unhappy at the decision to stop the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham from trying to return to Westminster. We'll hear from one angry MP and from the government.
Also in today's programme, would making social class a legally protected characteristic, like race or religion, help more people from working class backgrounds get jobs in the arts? And
he's done it! Has made history again.
We relive the hair-raising moments when a man scaled one of the world's tallest buildings without any ropes or harnesses, live on television. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Charles Carroll.
President Trump says his administration is reviewing everything connected to the fatal shooting of a US citizen in Minneapolis by federal immigration agents, the second this month. There are growing calls from within Mr. Trump's Republican Party for a full investigation into the killing of 37-year-old Alex Preti. The former presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton have both issued statements calling on Americans to stand up and defend their values. More protests have been taking place in Minneapolis against the Immigration Enforcement Agency, known as ICE. Our correspondent Tom Bateman is there.
Protesters are vowing to stay on the streets of Minneapolis until the ICE agents leave, deepening the rift with the Trump administration, while the president is demanding the city and state's Democrat authorities hand over immigrants with criminal convictions and without permission to be in the United States. However, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Trump struck a slightly more conciliatory tone over the killing of Alex Preti, twice declining to say that the border agent who killed him had acted appropriately, instead stressing that the administration was reviewing the incident. Amid signs he could be looking for a political way through the crisis, public opinion polling may be weighing on the White House, with some research suggesting a growing minority of Trump voters see the ICE raids as too aggressive in nature.
And the price of gold has surged to a record high, above $5,000 an ounce. It's seen as a safer asset for investors during times of economic uncertainty. 2 years ago, the price of gold was just above $2,000 an ounce. The decision by Labour's ruling body to stop the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, from standing in an upcoming by-election has angered some of the party's MPs. They say that he would have been the best candidate for the Gorton and Denton seat, and barring him is an own goal, which makes the Prime Minister look weak. Mr. Burnham, who's seen as a potential leadership rival to Sir Keir Starmer, said he was disappointed. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
The most catastrophic mistake is how one Labour MP described the decision by Sir Keir Starmer to vote to block Andy Burnham, adding that disgruntled backbenchers hope to try to put pressure on Labour's leadership to rethink. Sir Keir was one of the members of the ruling NEC panel who voted 8-1 to stop Mr. Burnham standing. Their argument, if he won the Westminster seat, he'd have to stand down as mayor, leading to an expensive election for that post, which should be avoided. In response, Mr. Burnham posted on social media that he was concerned the decision might harm Labour's chances in the by-election.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has pledged to get more police out of offices and onto the streets as part of her overhaul of policing in England and Wales. Forces will have to respond faster to emergency calls under the plans, which will be published this afternoon. Our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha, has the details.
People are waiting too long for a response after reporting a crime, Shabana Mahmood has said. She's proposing a new national standard Officers will have to reach the scene of the most serious incidents within 15 minutes in cities and 20 minutes in rural areas. And forces will be expected to answer 999 calls within 10 seconds. Experts from the most successful forces will be sent in to those failing to deliver. The government has already announced the creation of a new National Police Service and regional hubs to target crime across county borders. Some serving officers question whether the targets are realistic, with fewer frontline police.
The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has written to head teachers in England saying all schools should be mobile phone free. Her letter, seen by BBC News, says phones shouldn't be used in lessons, including for research or as calculators, or outside them during breaks. The General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, Pepe D'Asio, supports Ms. Phillipson's statement.
This gives absolute clarity. It takes away any ambiguity and in some respects is something that's great for parents, but most importantly will help young people understand how important it is to not be so reliant on their phone, to have their phone out of the way and out of reach during school times.
Israel says that it's searching a cemetery in northern Gaza for the body of the last remaining hostage taken during the October the 7th attacks. Last night, the Israeli Prime Minister's office said that the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt would be opened once the remains of Ran Gvili were found, but only for pedestrians, not for goods. The UK and nine other European countries are joining forces to back a new generation of wind farms in the North Sea. They would supply electricity to more than one country using undersea cables and could generate enough power for tens of millions of homes in the UK. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlett.
The Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, will sign a declaration in Hamburg later this morning committing to complete the huge scheme by 2050. Undersea cables already connect the electricity grids of European countries together. The UK has 10 such cables, but connecting wind farms directly to multiple countries will be a first. The idea is the electricity these new wind farms generate will be directed to whichever country needs it most, smoothing spikes in demand and reducing prices.
And researchers have found that spider monkeys share insider knowledge about where to find the best fruit trees in the forest rather than foraging at random. The scientists, who studied the behaviour of the animals in Mexico for 7 years, say they constantly change their social subgroups, allowing them to exchange tips about the best feeding spots. The findings are published in the journal NPJ Complexity.
Thank you, Charles. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's see what the weather is going to look like today with Helen Willetts. Morning, Helen.
Hello, Anna. Good morning. Low pressure is with us again. So although relatively quiet first thing this morning, we have got another potent area of low pressure coming in tonight and tomorrow. It does look as if we're going to see some widely wet and windy weather once again. There are numerous warnings out already from the Met Office, and they start actually with today's rain for Northern Ireland from lunchtime. Let's start with England and Wales. So it's going to be cloudy with drizzly showers around and just generally quite grey, but relatively mild, 7 to 10 degrees Celsius. But that rain does come in through the southwest of England and through Wales during this afternoon. So pretty miserable by the end of the day in the rush hour. And actually a driving wind as well, picking up with gales around the Irish Sea coasts. For Northern Ireland, we've already got some patchy rain this morning, and it's just going to get heavier, more persistent as we go through this afternoon, hence the warning here, with stronger winds as well, picking up 5 to 7 are highs. To Scotland, well, it's here we have the best chance of any sunshine today in the northwest. But there are showers pestering parts of northern Scotland, central and eastern Scotland as well. So a little bit of brightness in between, hopefully. But we've got that rain approaching the west, the Hebrides, by the end of play, and with gale force winds accompanying it. So temperatures are only about 4 to 7 degrees because they're still wintry, those showers over the hills. Now, overnight tonight, widespread heavy rain will make its way northwards and eastwards across, again, Northern Ireland, Wales, central southern England. Snow over the hills as it gets into northern England, western Scotland as well. And gales or even severe gale force winds, which will batter parts during tomorrow as well.
Helen, thank you very much indeed. Just coming up to 9 minutes past six now. Let's take our first look at the morning papers, dominated by the decision of the Labour Party, or its national executive at least, to block Andy Burnham from running in that by-election that's coming up in Manchester. The Telegraph quotes the letter said to be circulating amongst backbenchers with its headline, Labour in revolt over Burnham stitch-up. The former Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner also considers the move a mistake, according to the paper.
The Guardian says Labour risks a civil war. Its report notes that many of the party members unhappy with the decision aren't natural allies of Andy Burnham, but are growing weary of Sir Keir's leadership. The Eye and the Sun's headlines also talk of that Labour civil war.
The Daily Mirror says Sir Keir has deployed strong storm tactics by torpedoing Mr Burnham's comeback and derailing any leadership bid. The paper says the Prime Minister retained the support of loyalists despite the party backlash. But the Express says he's been accused of cowardice by a senior party figure, and the Mail warns Sir Keir has only hastened his demise by blocking Mr Burnham from running in the by-election. Its report says the Prime Minister will inevitably face a leadership challenge.
Sir Keir isn't the only leader facing a potential revolt within his party, according to the Financial Times. It says members of President Trump's Republican Party are breaking rank over the killings of two US citizens by immigration officers in Minneapolis. The paper quotes Oklahoma's Republican Governor Kevin Stitt, who said Donald Trump was getting bad advice on the situation.
The Times says China has sacked its most senior general over accusations that he leaked information about Beijing's nuclear weapons programs to the United States. The removal of Zhang Zhuxi gives President Xi control of his country's military affairs, the report says, to an extent unseen since Chairman Mao.
The Daily Telegraph says there were more than 700,000 people with a university degree out of work claiming benefits at the end of last year. Its report focuses on figures from the Centre for Social Justice, which says an increasing number of graduates are getting degrees that fail to meet the skills required from employers.
Britain's oldest podcasters feature in the Daily Express, lifelong friends Doreen, Maureen and Anne, who've got a combined age of 272, have launched the online talk show from their care home. The paper quotes the group, who said they didn't know what a podcast was, but likened it to having a good natter over dinner.
Not that far off, really, are they? It's 11 minutes past six now. Thousands of people in the US city of Minneapolis, as we were just saying there, have been gathering at a makeshift shrine overnight to remember Alex Pretty, the nurse shot dead by ICE agents. Anna Feige is a BBC reporter who's been at those protests, and she told me what the atmosphere is like on the streets right now.
There's a lot of sadness and a lot of anger, I would say. People are really, really frustrated. People are quite emotional. A lot of the people who we've seen are crying or hugging. It's tense and it's somber.
How do people feel about their own security, personal security there, given what's happened?
There's a mix of large immigrant community here and a white population as well. And what's interesting is, of course, the immigrant communities here, particularly the Somalian community here, has long feared for their safety since ICE has arrived here on the scene. But since the two shootings, both of white individuals, a number of white residents in the area are also now fearing for their safety. And multiple people today told me, white people today told me that, you know, it could happen to me now too. It could happen to anybody.
And what more do we know about Alex Pretty, the man who was killed? Because his friends, family, co-workers, former co-workers seem to be really pushing to make sure that a narrative that he did something wrong doesn't take hold.
Yeah, we've heard from former colleagues of his that his like principal light post in life was doing what was right, whether that be when he was working in the hospital as an ICU nurse or when he was demonstrating on the streets. And obviously, we know now that he had a gun on him before he was shot and killed. A number of his colleagues have said, you know, he was a firm Second Amendment supporter, but he was also he also put safety first.
And what about the way that ICE officers are operating on the streets now since this happened? Have you seen or has anybody seen any change in the way that they're working?
They've moved away from the central area where Alex was shot on Saturday. They've moved to another part of the city today and brought their operations there. So it's really local law enforcement as well as the National Guard, which has been deployed at the directive of the governor in Minnesota, who we've seen on the streets in that area. However, in the areas where ICE has relocated, just a few kilometers away from where Alex was shot, they are continuing with their operations.
That's Anna Feige. We're going to hear more from Minneapolis as well later in the programme.
It's 13 minutes past six now. All schools should be mobile free. So says the Education Secretary for England, who's written to all head teachers. Our education reporter, Hayley Clark, has been looking at what she's got to say. Morning to you, Hayley. Ministers always insist there's no need for a ban on mobiles in schools. So what does this letter change?
morning. While Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson, she's essentially written to head teachers to say, make sure pupils don't use phones at all at school. So that's not during lessons for research or as calculators, not during break time or lunchtime either. So that's really saying all of England schools should be phone free for the entire day is the message from the government. And she's saying that previous guidance on phones from on phones in schools did not deliver the clarity or consistency that schools need. So she says she strengthened the guidance to make it really explicit that people should not be using their phones at school. Now, Shadow Education Secretary Laura Trott has responded to this, saying it's yet more guidance on smartphones in schools and says it doesn't represent action and it's just more delay. And says if we're serious about protecting children, then we must legislate to ban phones in schools as well as getting under 16s off social media.
So there's still no ban, but the education secretary is saying the school inspectors in England, Ofsted, are going to get involved in policing these rules.
Yes. So the government has said Ofsted's also going to be involved and will be inspecting schools on how they implement their mobile phone policies going forward. So in the letter from Bridget Phillipson today, it says to reinforce the importance of the implementation, Ofsted will, for the first time, examine both schools' mobile phone policies and how effectively they're applied when they're judging behaviour during inspections. So that's been met with some opposition from the unions. So the teaching unions have generally welcomed the mobile phone guidance and the social media consultation, but have pushed back on that suggestion of Ofsted monitoring schools' mobile phone policy. So particularly around teachers' use of mobile phones, as Ofsted have advised teachers not use their phones in front of pupils. So Paul Whiteman, General Secretary of the National Association of Head Teachers, last week said school leaders need support from the government, not the threat of heavy-handed inspection.
Hayley Clark, our education reporter, thank you.
16 minutes past six, control of the supply chain for critical minerals has been in focus again in recent days, particularly because President Trump believes there are untapped reserves of them in Greenland. Many people say that's why he's got one eye on it. But in the last few days, the government here has also relaunched its own critical minerals strategy. And Will Baines here with more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Anna. Morning, Nick. Yes, the government being pretty clear about this, not playing it down at all, the importance of the supply chain in this sector, and they're updated critical minerals strategy published in the last couple of days. The foreword warns without them, the critical minerals that is, our lives would grind to a halt, industries would shut down overnight, and communities would not be able to function. All this comes as just this morning, the Financial Times is reporting that the US government is also planning to inject $1.6 billion into an American rare earth company there, its biggest investment in the sector. Will Dawes joins us. Will's the chief executive of Macanga, a resources firm, and director of Hypromag as well. Will, morning.
Good morning.
Why don't you explain, first of all, the Hypromag bit as well, what you guys do, because you're in the kind of sort of recycling business of these.
Well, that's right. Well, at the moment, rare earth magnets are used in a whole range of applications, whether it's electric vehicles, hard disk drives, wind turbines, drones, robotics. And when those applications reach end of life, a lot of that material and those critical materials, rare earths, ends up in landfill and it isn't recycled. And that's why less than 1% of rare earth magnets are recycled. So we have a critical material ending up in landfill, which we need to capture that material. And Hypromag has the technology to do that.
Right. And this was a spin out from Birmingham University, wasn't it, as well?
That's right. So Birmingham University is a center of excellence for magnetic materials on a sort of global scale. So magnets, hydrogen processing, recycling. Hypromag works in partnership with the University of Birmingham, scaling up this recycling technology, which really enables you to liberate these magnets from end-of-life assemblies before they go to shredding. So we can capture that material.
And what is the scale of that right now? How much can you recycle?
So at the moment, we're just starting up at the moment at Tyersley Energy Park in Birmingham, scale of about 100 up to around 300 tonnes a year of rare earth magnets. So we liberate the material and remake them into magnets. So
and just
this
put
is
that
the
in
first,
a bit of context yeah. for people.
Yeah, so so what we do, if you have a magnet embedded in a electric vehicle rotor, for example, that is put into a hydrogen vessel. The hydrogen is pumped in. The hydrogen reacts with that magnet in situ, demagnetizes, forms a powder, and we separate that powder. So it's a way to liberate and extract the magnet that's embedded in an assembly. Then we can reuse that material. Effectively, it's urban mining.
And in terms of the scale then at the moment, how much of the kind of UK's need can you do, and do you think you could do through this technology, and how much would have to be done through sort of old-fashioned mining, which was another area of the business you're in?
Yeah, so I'd say, you know, recycling doesn't provide the whole solution. We'd expect that percentage to go from less than 1% up to, I don't know, 30, 40, 50% of supply from recycled materials. So what we're looking to do in Birmingham is scale up that plant to around 1,000 tonnes a year minimum. And we're kicking off that process now.
And from a policy perspective, are there things that would help?
No, absolutely. I think there's a range of things. What we need to ensure is those end-of-life assemblies don't end up being sent overseas. We need to capture that material in the UK. And really, it's government support and funding to scale up.
Will, thanks so much for your time this morning. Will Dawes there, the Chief Executive of Macango and the Director of Hypermag. Well, Sunaina Sinha-Haldea is also with us this morning. Sunaina is the Global Head of Private Capital Advisory at Raymond James, here to look through what's moving financial markets this Monday morning. Sunaina, morning. And the price of gold, first of all, I know when these things sort of start hitting records, they keep hitting records, but does it tell us a little bit about what's going on that it's now past this $5,000 mark?
Yes, it's actually unbelievable that we are still talking about gold and keep talking about it week on week, it seems, with new record highs, but really very much a reflection of all the geopolitical uncertainty and escalating global tensions and friction points around the world, but also central bank demand, especially in emerging markets like China, which are on a sustained gold buying program to diversify their reserves away from the US dollar. Also feeding into what's happening here. And also gold is a reflection often of a weaker US dollar, which has been a trend over the last year that continues.
Yeah, a trend kind of driven a little bit by, will they, won't they, with tariffs, but also uncertainty a little bit right around the independence of decision-making at the central bank, the Federal Reserve. And we may or may not get some more news this week on that. How much is the market watching out for potentially a new Fed chair?
Indeed, we were meant to have heard fairly soon, as early as this week, in terms of a new Fed chair appointment by President Trump. We also have a potential new front runner, or certainly contender, joining the fray with BlackRock executive Rick Ryder, who's emerging, at least in the prediction markets, as a new favorite. So all remains to be seen. We have a Fed decision coming up this week. Many market participants, most market participants, feel the Fed will leave the rates unchanged, but that will certainly not be without a ton of political commentary around that decision.
Yeah, and not just that in terms of economic terms that the market's going to be watching out for as well, but also the biggest companies on the planet, most of them releasing their financial results this week as well, Sunaina.
Indeed, you have Meta, Microsoft, Tesla, Apple, all going out with earnings. And I think seeing AI strategies of the various large players this week and what the commentary around that is, what the return on investment plans are around each of their moves would be very interesting for the market to take in.
Yeah, any of those in particular that you're watching out for most keenly?
I think very interesting to see what's going to happen at Apple, which is really going into a very big year here with Tim Cook's succession on the horizon. But Apple's taken a very different take to AI investment. They've essentially made themselves kingmaker in terms of partnering with whoever's making the best AI products out there. Currently, they've put their money on Google as it takes a turn here to catch up in the AI race with this partnership. So it'll be interesting to see what they say about that and how the market reacts to that.
Sunaina, thanks as always for your time. Sunaina Sinha-Haldea, the Head of Private Capital Advisory at Raymond James. Well, the Hollywood battle for control of Warner Brothers Discovery continues also to rumble on in the background as one of the big corporate stories of the week, with both Netflix and Paramount, of course, still vying for control of the company. But there has been an increasing unease from the cinema industry around the world about what any future deal might mean for the supply of new films to their screens. And Tim Richards is with us. Tim, the founder and chief executive of View International. Morning, Tim. Is it a concern that's one that's now creeping into your mind?
Well, I think it's not only just the cinema, it's the entire creative community worldwide.
Netflix, for the last 28 years, have not been supporters of the industry at all. And in fact, they've actually been quite against the industry, which is fine because I've never looked at what happens at home as being competition for cinemas and out-of-home entertainment. And but if you look at certainly the comments that Ted Sarandos and Netflix have made up until 2 weeks ago, they were overwhelmingly negative against cinemas. I mean, he's been quoted for saying things like, movies for cinemas are an outmoded idea. The consumers want to watch movies at home, you know, and he's just not been a supporter until 2 weeks ago.
I was going to say, he does say his deal is saving Hollywood rather than wrecking it when that was put to him a week or so ago on their earnings call.
No, exactly. And I think certainly, I mean, this is, and, you know, to put it into context, this is somebody who legitimately has built an incredible company, a $320 billion company. And he's made a $83 billion offer for Warner Brothers. One could say he's a sophisticated investor. And suddenly, 2 weeks ago, his team told him that Warner Brothers actually made movies that made money. And this is after Warner Brothers had an incredible year with a $4 billion of box office and including Sinners, which has had, you know, 12, 14 nominations for an Oscar. And suddenly they love movies and are going to release movies. I mean, it's, and the contrast.
You just don't buy that, do you, by the sound of things? Because Netflix also in a statement to us have told us they'll be releasing more movies for cinema release if they bought Warner Brothers. It sounds like you don't buy that.
Well, I think one has to look at actions and not words. And certainly for 28 years, they have not supported the industry at all. The only releases that they have made, and they claim to have made 30 releases last year, the only releases that they've made have been releases in order to qualify for a BAFTA or an Oscars. In fact, it was getting so bad that when All Quiet for the Western Front, an incredible movie, played at a handful of screens only in London, and qualified and then won a BAFTA for Best Film. As a consequence, BAFTA and the Academy for the Oscars had to change the rules to make it more difficult so that there was it was a proper theatrical release. The contrast to all this is the competition at Paramount with David Ellison. David Ellison is a highly respected filmmaker through Skydance, a long track record of releasing and supporting the industry. And he has made a private and a public commitment to release 15 movies a year before the Warner Brothers opportunity even came up. And he has also said that if they are successful, that they will guarantee that they'll release at least 30 movies a year. So it's, you know, one's got this track record and one doesn't. And I think you just have to kind of weigh up who you really believe is going to be good for the industry.
So it sounds like if it's a deal, from your perspective, Paramount would be preferable, but is no deal at all actually the most preferable option?
I spent 8 years of my life at Warner Brothers, this incredible studio, and I think it's sad to lose a studio. But what has happened in the last year is the world will not end when Warner Brothers sells, because we've had the tech industry embrace theatrical releases and embrace movies. I mean, you have Bezos, Cook, and Ellison making major commitments to the industry going forward.
That's going to be a story that we're going to keep coming back to, isn't it? Tim, thanks for your time. Tim Richards, the boss of View, then.
Will, thank you very much indeed. Coming up to 28 minutes past six. Here's Carthy with the sport.
Is that all you're going to say?
Well, I saw that you were going to talk about the tennis, and I thought, frankly, the lead story at 10 past 8 should be Manchester United's revival.
So I'm still yes. arguing. Controversially, I am going to start with the tennis, but we will get to Manchester United in a moment, because there is live sport happening across the other side of the world. We are into week two of tennis's Australian Open. The reigning Wimbledon champions Jannik Sinner and Iga Świątek are both in action later, and the BBC's tennis correspondent Russell Fuller can bring us up to date with what's happened so far this morning. Russell.
And another strong reason for starting with the tennis, Kathy and Nick, is that the defending champion is out. Madison Keys has been beaten overnight by Jessica Pegula 6-3, 6-4, and will now play Amanda Anisimova in the quarterfinals. She's chasing a third consecutive Grand Slam final and had victory earlier over the unseeded Wang Jingyu. In the men's draw, Italy's fifth seed Lorenzo Musetti continues to look impressive, especially as he laboured for 4.5 hours in extreme heat on Saturday. He came through in straight sets against Taylor Fritz. Jannik Sinner and Iga Świątek are still to come, but Henry Patton and his Finnish partner Harry Heliavaara, the reigning men's doubles champions here, are out. They've fallen at the third round stage, beaten in two tiebreaks by the Czech pair of Nuzza and Ricky.
Thank you very much, Russell. Tennis Breakfast continues on Five Sports Extra and BBC Sounds. This bulletin is not just throwing together two matches in charge for Michael Carrick as caretaker boss at Manchester United and two wins over the top two sides in the Premier League, Manchester City, and last night a 3-2 victory over Arsenal.
We got there.
Exactly. It took 30 seconds, but we're there. Arsenal's lead at the top of the table is now down to 4 points. United are in fourth place, with Carrick focusing on continuing their form.
That's where we've got to be as a group, you know. We've got to be greedy. We want more of this feeling. We've got to keep our feet on the ground and understand why we've had these results and what it's going to take moving forward to keep improving and keep pushing.
United are now above Liverpool, who are in sixth place. Chelsea are in fifth, and they beat Crystal Palace 3-1 yesterday. Third place, Aston Villa had a 2-0 win over Newcastle United, while struggling Nottingham Forest beat Brentford 2-0. And the top two sides in the Scottish Premiership, Hearts and Celtic, drew 2-2 yesterday. Derek McInnes's Hearts side have a 4-point lead at the top of the table.
This isn't just a manager or a group of players, it's a whole club working together for something better. There's a lot of ambition, the fans are buying into it. For us to be top of the league for now over 4 months, there's something real there.
Rangers beat Dundee 3-0 to overtake Celtic and move into second place, just 4 points off Hearts. Manchester City women's 2-1 win over London City Lionesses increases City's lead at the top of the Women's Super League to 9 points. And the Seattle Seahawks will face the New England Patriots in Super Bowl 60. That's a rematch of the 2015 NFL title decider. Super Bowl 60 is on Sunday, February the 8th. We'll be talking about Arsenal United in more detail in the next hour.
Quite a small round of applause there from my colleague. Thank you, Kathy.
The hunt for Lord Sugar's new business partner is on.
The next 12 weeks will be the toughest of your life.
And this year's candidates are going to bring in the money.
We can go in at 10K.
For $10,000, we'd expect a private jet to the pyramids.
What?
Going to take on the world.
We're running about Hong Kong and it's absolutely chaotic.
Going to face the music.
One of the worst performances in the history of this process. You're fired.
The Apprentice starts on Thursday on BBC iPlayer.
Time now, 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and a very cheerful Nick Robinson this morning. And Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
President Trump has indicated that he might at some point withdraw immigration enforcement officials from Minneapolis as outrage grows over the fatal shooting of a nurse by federal agents on Saturday. Mr. Trump also said that his administration was reviewing everything connected to the shooting. The former presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton have both issued statements calling on Americans to stand up and defend their values. Labour's decision to ban the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, from standing in an upcoming by-election has been openly criticised by some of the party's backbenchers. Mr. Burnham says he's disappointed and he criticised the way Labour is run. The Mayor is seen as a potential leadership rival to Sir Keir Starmer if he becomes an MP. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has promised to make police respond quicker to 999 calls. Under new plans, forces in England and Wales will be required to respond to emergency calls within 15 minutes in urban areas and within 20 minutes in rural areas. It's part of a wider overhaul, which will be outlined this afternoon. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has written to head teachers in England saying all schools should be mobile phone free. In a letter to schools, seen exclusively by the BBC, she said that it was not appropriate for phones to be used as calculators or for research during lessons or during break times. Ofsted will inspect schools on the implementation of their mobile phone policies. Gold prices have hit a record high, above $5,000 an ounce. Investors turn to the precious metal during times of economic uncertainty, as it's seen as a safer asset. And the UK is to back new offshore wind projects in the North Sea alongside nine other European countries. For the first time, some of the new wind farms will be linked to several nations through undersea cables, which supporters say should lower prices across the region. However, wind farm operators would be able to shop around between countries to sell power to the highest bidder, potentially driving up electricity prices when supply is tight.
Thank you, Charles. 27 minutes to seven. A stitch up to save Starmer skin, or a necessary if ruthless decision to prevent months of political bloodletting? That is the debate raging inside the Labour Party on the morning after the decision to block the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham from running for Parliament for Labour in a by-election. Our chief political correspondent has his ear to the ground, Henry Zeffman. Morning to you. How cross are they?
Pretty cross, but I think crucially not so cross that it feels like the Labour leadership is going to have to change its decision. I mean, there is a backlash, but it does not feel overwhelming. Yes, the backlash is not confined to the so-called usual suspects. There are lots of MPs who are unhappy. Indeed, there are cabinet ministers I'm aware of who disagree with this decision by the National Executive Committee officers group. But they don't plan to say so publicly. And there are plenty, by the way, some saying so publicly, who are happy that he's been blocked. Some because they don't want the drama of Andy Burnham coming back to Westminster and speculation about him trying to become leader. Some because they want a different candidate to succeed Sir Keir Starmer when the time comes. So I think this morning, the Prime Minister's allies will be feeling vindicated, at least for now, in the judgment that they evidently made, which was that there was no great option here. But blocking Andy Burnham was, from the Prime Minister's point of view, the least bad.
Well, take us through their thinking, because blocking him was bound to produce a row, bound to produce cries that he's weak, that he's undemocratic. So why do it?
Well, for all that yesterday was an assertion of organisational strength, not just blocking Andy Burnham, but blocking him with an 8-1 vote, with the charge being led by Keir Starmer himself, you're absolutely right, it is a reflection of weakness as well. Political weakness. Weakness because for all Andy Burnham's assertions of wanting to do his part, the clear fear among Sir Keir Starmer's allies was not merely that as an MP he would challenge him for the leadership, but that he would win, that Andy Burnham would have become Prime Minister by perhaps the end of this year. It's also an admission of weakness because, look, that wasn't the public argument advanced. The public argument advanced for blocking Andy Burnham was about the political and organisational risks of a by-election for the Greater Manchester mayoralty. Well, that's a position which has been contested three times and Labour has never won less than 63% of the vote. And yet we are told that Downing Street fears it could be lost to Reform UK in a by-election. That's quite the admission of political weakness. An admission, too, by the way, that around Sir Keir Starmer, they believe the opinion polls. And in terms of where this goes next, I mean, we've talked a lot, haven't we, Nick, about questions which might erupt about Keir Starmer's leadership in the aftermath of the May elections. Well, we're expecting this by-election in Gorton and Denton, at which Andy Burnham won't be the Labour candidate, to take place pretty quickly, perhaps as soon as February the 26th. Well, should Labour's candidate lose, I think that would prompt a huge bout of leadership turbulence.
Henry, thank you very much.
It's 24 minutes to seven now.
There's to be a new national standard for police response times to 999 calls in England and Wales. Daniel Sanford is our Home Affairs correspondent. Morning to you, Daniel. What exactly is being promised by ministers and do we know when we're going to get it?
So what they're saying is that a 999 call should be answered within 10 seconds and that the police should respond to the most serious incidents. So that's one where there's, you know, threat to life or where the offender might still be at the scene and similar scenarios like that. They should respond to the most serious incidents within 15 minutes in a city or 20 minutes in a rural area. This is part of a huge, enormous policing white paper being published later today. Some measures in that white paper will be put into a bill this year, and I imagine that if this needs legislation, that'll be in that bill. Other bits of that won't get into the bill this year and will take much longer to implement.
Yeah, I asked about timing because it's pretty clear, isn't it, that plans for a new national police service above the existing forces are going to take many years to come into fruition.
Yes, I mean, this is really, really a very, very large set of proposals for reforming policing. Some of it, as I say, could be done within a year through legislation. Some of it can even be done without legislation. But the two really, really big bits of work, the formation of a national police service by merging the National Crime Agency and counter-terrorism policing to create something that really is quite similar to the FBI in the United States, that's going to take longer. And then the really sort of big ticket item, reducing the number of police forces in England and Wales from 43 to something closer to 15, that's going to be something which I'm not sure can be done by the next general election. And as you were just discussing, the state of the opinion polls, it's not clear it will necessarily be the same party in power at the next general election. So it may be that some of this would never happen if there's a change of whoever's in power.
Daniel Sanford, our Home Affairs correspondent. Thank you.
It's 21 minutes to seven. A huge winter storm in the US has left more than a million people without power. Floyd Cush is our reporter in Washington, D.C. Floyd, how bad has this been and what areas in particular are we looking at here?
Hi there, Anna. Yeah, this has been a huge winter storm that has really moved through a huge part of the US with that triple threat of snow, ice and freezing cold temperatures. And we saw about 30 centimetres or a foot of snow in at least 17 states. I'm here in Washington, D.C. We're actually on the National Mall. It's quite a picture here. We saw heavy snow at blanket the National Mall. So quite a beautiful scene, actually. And we saw a lot of people come down to see this picturesque scene on the National Mall with this snow accumulated. But that snow has brought big concerns, and we're seeing major concerns around the ice accumulation in large parts of the US, the ice accumulating on power lines and tree branches, leading to power outages, around a million homes and businesses suffering those power outages. Combine that with plunging temperatures, overnight temperatures down to minus 20 degrees. That's expected to continue over the coming days. So authorities are very concerned about those without power, may not have another way to heat their homes. Combine that with those very cold temperatures, and there's a really real cause for concern. The other massive disruption has been to travel. We've seen 12,000 flights cancelled over the course of the weekend in the US, and more than 3,000 cancelled into Monday, and that's expected to worsen.
And Floyd, as you said there, it is going to continue for a few more days. Are the resources in place? Are the authorities geared up to deal with this?
Yes, yeah, so Anna, we saw a massive amount of preparation go into preparing for this storm in New York, and here in DC we saw trucks mobilized and plows prepared to try to clear the roads. And we also saw that response in states that haven't seen, that don't typically see really cold weather like this. But what we're hearing from some power providers is that they're looking at this being a weeks-long operation to restore power as opposed to days, which is really concerning. Obviously, they're doing everything they can to get the power back on. We saw President Trump approve emergency declarations for at least a dozen states with the hope that that fast tracks the resources that they need to help people. But the major message that we're hearing from authorities is for people to stay off roads, stay home and stay safe, because these plunging temperatures are really going to be a huge concern for up to a week in many states. And so the message is to stay put and stay safe.
Floyd Cush in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
18 minutes to 7 now. 5 years after Aung San Suu Kyi was jailed by the military regime in Myanmar, the country is going to the polls in an election which has been widely dismissed as a sham. Suu Kyi is out of public view. Her party is banned from taking part. So the military-backed party is guaranteed to win. The leader of the coup, which brought the military to power, General Minh Aung Hlaing, is expected to remain president once the new parliament sits in a couple of months' time. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head has been following the election since it began last month, and reports now from Shan State in eastern Myanmar. ¶¶
A small truck with a very large speaker reminds residents in the lakeside town of Nyong Shwe that it's time to vote. The people are joining together to build a new nation, goes the song. And indeed, inside the town's main secondary school, voters are guided by officials to where they can cast their ballots in what looks like a model democratic exercise. Except it isn't. A climate of fear hangs over this month-long, three-stage election, organised by the military clique which seized power 5 years ago, though that suggestion did not please Senior Election Commissioner Kin Mong-u.
We conduct the election free, fair, credible and transparent.
People I've spoken to are very scared, frightened. They feel they are forced to vote. They say they cannot say anything about the election. That makes it seem like it's not
really
fair.
No, it is not true. You can ask everyone. You can ask the question everyone. It is not true. That is you are listening to false news.
But we found you can't just ask everyone. Few dare say anything after seeing hundreds of people charged under a law criminalising any criticism of the poll. It didn't help that everywhere we went in Shan State, we were constantly followed by military, police and other officials. Every restaurant where we ate, every hotel we stayed in, got a visit. And they were clearly terrified by this. There was almost no campaigning. And we found we were not allowed to see it anyway.
So we're on a really tiny road winding through the Shan Hills, trying to find a village where the Pa'o National Organization is holding an election event. We've been through two checkpoints. We've actually been chased down by what appear to be, might be police officers, and they're now checking every aspect of our car and our documents. Minglaba. Very nice to meet you, sir. We have permission, yes.
The local army commander introduced himself and then questioned all the documents we'd been given by the government authorising us to cover the election in his area. He could not be persuaded to let us through. In an effort to shake off the surveillance, we took a boat out onto Inlay Lake, but soon found we were being followed even there by a military intelligence officer.
So we've been trying to talk to these ethnic Intar fishermen who work on the lake about the election, what their hopes are for the future, but our military intelligence escort is just behind us, and to be honest, they're too scared to say very much at all. One said the political situation is not good. The rest of them don't really want to comment.
On reaching a lakeside temple, it seemed the right place to confront our unwanted escort.
Milaba, can I ask, why have you been following us all the way across the lake?
It's for your safety, he said. As an officer, it's my duty, because you're foreigners. We did manage to lose him briefly in a weaver's workshop and spoke to a group of men eating their lunch, helpfully well out of sight. I asked them how business was these days.
Now it's not good.
No tourists.
That 2019, 2018 is very good.
So do you hope that after the election it will get better?
Don't know.
You don't think so?
No.
Are people frightened to talk about the election?
Yeah, everybody like it.
Everyone's scared?
Yeah.
There is no sense that the people of Myanmar are being offered a choice in this election. They know that what they'll get will be continued military rule in civilian costume and with a parliament of sorts, but still with the repression, violence and intimidation which have blighted the 5 years since the coup.
Jonathan Head reporting from Myanmar.
It's 13 minutes to 7. The UN Human Rights Council has voted to expand its investigations into the violent regime clampdown on protesters in Iran, which killed thousands of people. It is difficult to know the exact number, but videos that have managed to come out of the country, people have managed to get some through that internet shutdown, and they've shown large numbers of bodies in morgues across the country. Well, Payam Akhavan is an Iranian-born Canadian international lawyer, human rights advocate and professor. Joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
What I think is quite difficult at the moment, we see the UN Human Rights Council having this vote, we see Iran rejecting it, and there is a perception at the moment that something absolutely terrible has happened in Iran and that the wider world is not doing enough to try and establish exactly how many have been killed and how.
Even by conservative estimates and even against the blood-stained record of the Islamic Republic, which is well documented by the UN, this is by far the worst, most unprecedented mass killing. On January 23rd, when I was speaking before the Human Rights Council, we received a report from a network of physicians within Iran that, based on clinical and forensic records, statistical extrapolation have arrived at a conservative estimate of at least 33,000 people having been killed within a span of a few days. Now, I used to be a UN prosecutor at The Hague. I drafted the indictment for the Srebrenica genocide in July 1995, when some 8,000 Bosnian Muslims were killed. So the Islamic Republic has killed two or three times that number of people in half the time. So that should give us a sense of the staggering scale. And in my opinion, this begins to resemble not just a crime against humanity, as it is defined in the statute of the International Criminal Court, but it begins to resemble specifically the crime of extermination. And this is indeed what is happening. Even injured people are being taken out of hospitals and being executed. Injured people in morgues are being killed point blank. So this is truly a horrific, horrific nightmare that the Iranian people are living through.
What legal challenges actually stem from this, given that you talked about that that study from a professor based in Munich who's modelled an estimate based on extrapolation. We've heard from the regime itself, which has said thousands. We've heard from the US-based human rights group HRANA. They say the total number of confirmed fatalities is about 5,500, but that the number will be higher than that. Given that people can't get in and see independently what has gone on, that's a real challenge for future legal action.
The truth will eventually come out. In 1988, at the end of the Iran-Iraq War, the Islamic Republic executed several thousand leftist political prisoners. It took many years for the truth to come out. But what is imperative now is the collation and preservation of the evidence. There are massive amounts of witness testimonies, videos coming out of the country. There are a network of human rights organizations that are collecting these. And the UN fact-finding mission has an important role to play to be a kind of clearinghouse and to impose some sort of quality control over this evidence. The resolution adopted by the Council refers to future legal proceedings. Currently, the International Criminal Court doesn't have jurisdiction because Iran has not accepted to sign the statute. The Security Council could make a referral under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, and I believe it should do so, even if it will be vetoed by the likes of China, Russia, possibly even the United States, which is hostile to the court presently. But I think as a matter of principle, these crimes have to be addressed at the level of crimes against humanity. There should be efforts in the Security Council to refer to the ICC. Ultimately, I believe it will be for a special court in a future democratic Iran to bring the perpetrators of these heinous crimes to justice.
Paya Makovan, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It is now 8 minutes to seven. There's to be a new national standard for police response times to 999 calls in England and Wales, alongside plans for a new national police force to take over many of the tasks now done by local police forces. Well, we were hearing about that from our correspondent a few minutes ago, but we now hear from the man who chairs the National Police Chiefs Council, Gavin Stevens. Morning to Mr. Stevens.
Good morning.
Let's begin with those targets. What can be expected? And crucially, can you answer the question, which is apparently not in the information that we've been given, about how soon those targets for 999 calls will be met?
Well, it's really important for the community to know that when there's an emergency, the police will get there quickly, but also safely. All forces monitor these targets now. They're available for local communities to look at. Setting an expectation is important, but of course, this is also in a time where if you're a victim of domestic abuse or coercive and controlling behaviour, you might want a video chat call with a specialist within a few minutes rather than waiting for an officer to attend. Or if you're involved in a serious collision on a motorway, we may be able to get a drone up to see the situation first to know what resources to get there. The last big reform of policing was done in the early 1960s when policing didn't even have access to a pocket calculator. And now, of course, we live in a world of deepfakes and cybercrime. The world is changing and we have to keep up.
Well, we'll come to the wider reforms in a second. I'm still not clear, I'm afraid, when we get this new national standard for responding to 999 calls. Is this months? Is it next year? Or is this a long, long-term ambition?
Well, it's a matter for the Home Office to decide on implementation dates for the national standards. What I can say is that forces do monitor these things now and publish that data.
But you've not been told? You haven't been given a deadline?
Well, of course, the white paper's published later on this afternoon, so we all look forward to the details.
Well, you are making the broader case for reform of the police. The nature of crime has changed, although you will know, as I do, that I think virtually the first story I did as a journalist was about cutting the number of police forces in England, and it never happens. Mm-hmm. It has happened in Scotland. The argument against it there as well as here is it takes enormous amounts of time and resources to reorganise the police, and it means that people are further away from their local police force. It makes it more remote, more national.
Well, the argument about being further away is not made out. Before the 1960s, policing across the United Kingdom was based on a borough and district model, and that is still so important today. People consider their local team as what's in their area, their neighbourhood policing team, the borough and district level. What happens at the force level is the purchase of kit and equipment, the provision of IT, how the finances are managed. And over time, that's just become way too complicated. And it's also become unfair. Some people pay for less than 20% of their local policing budget through local taxation, some more than 50%. The system has got disorganised, and in the world that we live in today, where crime extends from the neighbourhood all the way up to national security, a fundamental reorganisation is needed.
But if you're in a small town, forgive me interrupting, Mr. Stevens, but if you're in a small town or you're in a village,
yeah,
you may fear that the decisions made in the future about policing will be made by some remote individual in a big city who's no idea what it means to you to have your village, your town, your farm, perhaps, the victim of crime. It will seem not an important priority.
No, the priority should be set at the local level. And one of the things in this plan is about the neighbourhood policing guarantee. It is absolutely essential that local policing teams set local priorities in an area. Let me give a practical example. My mum lives in rural North Yorkshire. I'm more concerned about her being scammed online for her savings than I am about having her car stolen or her property broken into. We need to deal with the spectrum of offending. Now, some of the best responses to preventing that cybercrime that she might be a victim of may be presented at the force level or even nationally. Obviously, if we're concerned about local crime in an area, shoplifting, mobile phone theft, livestock theft in the rural community, that is predominantly for local teams. Mm. And those priorities must be negotiated locally and still will be.
Do you have any concerns, finally, about the nationalisation of policing in this way? Because the Home Secretary says she wants to have the power to sack chief constables. Police officers have always valued their independence from politicians, that they have their own autonomy. Are you nervous that one individual in Whitehall can make these sorts of decisions?
Well, the emphasis has been on about sacking chief constables. I think the Home Office and the Home Secretary need a strong role in the identification of talent, the selection of chief officers, the support and development of those chief officers. Teams to help turn around performance. If forces are struggling, there's more support on that. A dignified exit if things are not working out, and only in exceptional circumstances where there is catastrophic failure, an intervention to remove somebody.
So you're not nervous?
I'm not nervous. I think it's important that policing are accountable to political leaders.
Got to leave it there, Mr. Stevens, I'm afraid. Important. Forgive me, got to go to the weather and news. Gavin Stevens, Chair of the National Police Chiefs Council.
Yeah, before that, let's look ahead to later this morning on Radio 4.
The question of immigration may divide America today, but it has been in its bloodstream since the beginning. This is James Naughtie. And in the next episode of An American Journey, I'll be exploring that past in Chicago, in California, across the Midwest, and ask how the country has struggled to meet, through many times of trouble, the challenge set by its founding fathers, who described their constitution as a path to a more perfect union, the idea that began it all. So what does an American identity mean today, and how has it shaped the country? An American Journey continues this morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
What has the weather got in store for us? Helen can tell us. Morning, Helen.
Nick, thanks. Hello there. Good morning to you. We've got another potent low brewing up towards the southwest. So for the day ahead, a fairly quiet affair in terms of what's coming. So for England and Wales, it's overcast, so fairly grey, mainly dry, drizzly showers around. Temperatures around about 7 to 10 degrees. But actually, the afternoon will bring heavier rain back into southwest England and across Wales. So a Met Office warning coming into force for that. Strong winds to go with it. For Northern Ireland, already it's cloudy with patchy rain, which will turn increasingly persistent and heavy through the afternoon today. Temperatures here around about 5 to 7 degrees Celsius, but the strong wind accompanying that rain, pretty nasty conditions for the evening rush hour here too. Met Office warning comes into force for that as well this afternoon. For Scotland, we might see some brightness northwest of the Highlands, but generally it's cloudy here as well. There are showers around, the wintry over the hills, across the Grampians particularly, but parts of the Highlands coming into southern and eastern areas really on that breeze, but it's not as windy as it has been. So temperatures around about 4 to 7 degrees Celsius, but really that potent low will unleash wet and windy weather across many parts through the night, a renewed risk of more heavy, potentially flooding rains and gale force winds widely, and that becomes the dominant feature through tomorrow. I think we'll have quite widespread gales, strong and gusty winds, and yet more heavy rain onto our saturated ground. So there are warnings in force, do check those out online.
Will do. Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 26th of January. The headlines: President Trump has said his administration is reviewing everything connected to the killing of a US citizen in Minneapolis by federal immigration agents, the second this month. More protests have been taking place overnight. Our correspondent Tom Bateman is in the city.
Well, one of the sounds you get used to here is the combination of the crunch of the snow and ice beneath your feet and the repeating chants of the protesters to get ice out of Minneapolis.
Sir Keir Starmer's facing a backlash from some MPs angered by the decision to bar the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham from running in a by-election. So is this a moment of weakness or strength for the Prime Minister? Two MPs will debate at 7:30. And the Home Secretary is promising to make police respond faster to 999 calls as part of a wider shake-up of forces in England and Wales.
Coming up in the next hour, how do we help more people from working-class backgrounds get jobs in the arts? And
he's done it! Arnold has made history again.
And he's done it live on television without any ropes, without any harnesses, climbing one of the world's tallest buildings. Stomach-turning stuff. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Charles Carroll.
President Trump says his administration is reviewing everything connected to the fatal shooting of a US citizen in Minneapolis by federal immigration agents, the second this month. There are growing calls from within Mr. Trump's Republican Party for a full investigation into the killing of 37-year-old Alex Pretty. The former presidents, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, have both issued statements calling on Americans to stand up and defend their values. More protests have been taking place in Minneapolis against the immigration enforcement agency known as ICE. Our correspondent Tom Bateman is there.
Protesters are vowing to stay on the streets of Minneapolis until the ICE agents leave, deepening the rift with the Trump administration, while the president is demanding the city and state's Democrat authorities hand over immigrants with criminal convictions and without permission to be in the United States. However, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Trump struck a slightly more conciliatory tone over the killing of Alex Pretty, twice declining to say that the border agent who killed him had acted appropriately, instead stressing that the administration was reviewing the incident. Amid signs he could be looking for a political way through the crisis, public opinion polling may be weighing on the White House, with some research suggesting a growing minority of Trump voters see the ICE raids as too aggressive in nature.
The decision by Labour's ruling body to stop the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, from standing in an upcoming by-election has angered some of the party's MPs. They say that he would have been the best candidate for the Gorton and Denton seat, and barring him is an own goal, which has made the Prime Minister look weak. Mr Burnham, who's seen as a potential leadership rival to Sir Keir Starmer, said he was disappointed by the decision and concerned about the potential impact on important elections ahead. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
The most catastrophic mistake is how one Labour MP described the decision by Sir Keir Starmer to vote to block Andy Burnham, adding that disgruntled backbenchers hope to try to put pressure on Labour's leadership to rethink. Sir Keir was one of the members of the ruling NEC panel who voted 8-1 to stop Mr Burnham standing. Their argument, if he won the Westminster seat, he'd have to stand down as mayor, leading to an expensive election for that post, which should be avoided. In response, Mr Burnham posted on social media that he was concerned the decision might harm Labour's chances in the by-election, and he complained that the media had been told before he had, saying, "Tells you everything about the way the Labour Party is being run these days." Labour sources said they had called him, but he hadn't answered.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has pledged to get more police out of offices and onto the streets as part of her overhaul of policing in England and Wales. Forces will have to respond faster to emergency calls under the plans, which will be published this afternoon. Our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha, has the details.
People are waiting too long for a response after reporting a crime, Shabana Mahmood has said, sometimes days. She's proposing a new national standard. Officers will have to reach the scene of the most serious incidents within 15 minutes in cities and 20 minutes in rural areas, and forces will be expected to answer 999 calls within 10 seconds. Currently, the police aren't held accountable if they fail to meet targets. The Home Office wants to change this with experts from the most successful forces sent in to those failing to deliver. The government has already announced the creation of a new National Police Service to tackle counter-terror, fraud and organise crime investigations, and new regional hubs to target drug trading and child sexual abuse happening across county borders. Shabana Mahmood says the changes will help to cut crime, but some serving officers question whether the targets are realistic with fewer frontline police.
The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has written to head teachers in England saying that all schools should be mobile phone free. Her intervention comes after the government issued fresh guidance last week aimed at strengthening existing rules and giving greater clarity. Our education reporter Hayley Clark has more.
In the letter, seen exclusively by BBC News, the Education Secretary says previous guidance on mobile phones didn't deliver the clarity or consistency that headteachers need, or set out for parents that no phones in school is a clear national position. Bridget Phillipson uses the letter to call on parents to back the new policies too. She says phones shouldn't be used in lessons, including for research or as calculators, or outside them, even during breaks. For the first time, Ofsted will also examine schools' mobile phone policies and their effectiveness when judging behaviour during inspections. But the government has, again, stopped short of making the ban law. There's been pressure building for months from the Conservatives, unions and parents calling for tougher rules. But some campaigners suggest allowing brick phones, which don't have the internet, could be a better solution.
Israel is searching a cemetery in northern Gaza for the body of the last remaining hostage taken during the October the 7th attacks. The Israeli Prime Minister's office has said that the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt will be opened once the remains of Rangvili are found, but only for pedestrians, not for goods. The price of gold has surged to a record high, above $5,000 an ounce. It's seen as a safer asset for investors during times of economic uncertainty. 2 years ago, gold cost just over $2,000 an ounce. The UK and nine other European countries are joining forces to back a new generation of wind farms in the North Sea. They would supply electricity to more than one country using undersea cables and could generate enough power for tens of millions of homes in the UK. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
The Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, will sign a declaration in Hamburg later this morning committing to complete the huge scheme by 2050. Undersea cables already connect the electricity grids of European countries together. The UK has 10 such cables, but connecting wind farms directly to multiple countries will be a first. The idea is the electricity these new wind farms generate will be directed to whichever country needs it most, smoothing spikes in demand and reducing prices. Mr. Miliband says the deal will strengthen the UK's energy security, offering an escape from what he calls the fossil fuel roller coaster. But the Shadow Energy Secretary Claire Coutinho said the rush to build wind farms at breakneck speed was pushing up everybody's energy bills.
Bowel cancer screening in England is to be brought into line with Scotland and Wales in order to catch more cases earlier. The NHS says that many more lives could be saved as a result. Frances Reid has the details.
It's the UK's fourth most common cancer and the second biggest cause of deaths from the disease in England. Now, the at-home screening tests used to detect early signs of bowel cancer will have thresholds lowered for follow-up tests to be carried out. The home testing kit's already offered to everyone over the age of 50, but this will see the number of people going for further colonoscopies rise by a third. The changes could cut late-stage diagnoses and deaths from bowel cancer by 6% and save the NHS around £32 million a year. They'll be brought in gradually so that services can meet demand. While it brings England into line with Scotland and Wales, the threshold for further tests will remain the same in Northern Ireland.
Researchers have found that spider monkeys share insider knowledge about where to find the best fruit trees in the forest rather than foraging at random. The scientists, who studied the behaviour of the animals in Mexico for 7 years, say they constantly change their social subgroups, allowing them to exchange tips about the best feeding spots.
Thank you, Charles. It's 9 minutes past seven. President Trump has called on officials in Minnesota to hand over what he calls all criminal illegal aliens to the federal authorities for immediate deportation. This is amid what is now a deepening crisis over his anti-immigration drive in the state. After the shooting dead on Saturday of a 37-year-old nurse, Alex Pretty, by border officials, the Democratic Governor Tim Walz has called for all of the agents of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, to leave. It is the second killing of an American by enforcement officials in the city this month. Our correspondent Tom Bateman reports from Minneapolis.
Well, one of the sounds you get used to here is the combination of the crunch of the snow and ice beneath your feet and the repeating chants of the protesters to get ICE out of Minneapolis. Thousands have turned out in the couple of days now since Alex Pretty was shot dead. A pretty astonishing move, because temperatures dropping down to about minus 25 Celsius overnight. It is extraordinarily cold. So you've got a nice hot cup of coffee to keep your hands warm. Good idea. What does the sign say?
Ice out
of Minnesota.
Yeah.
A day of truth and freedom. We both marched on Friday. The people of Minneapolis are tired, but very angry and
irate.
I fear where it's going to go is war. I do, because this is domestic terrorism. We are being terrorized. These are things that have happened in the past when regimes have taken over countries. We're divided. We are a nation divided.
When you hear the Trump administration say this is legitimate law enforcement, they're carrying out this elected pledge for a deportation drive, and actually they're blaming the protesters, the observers, saying that this is impeding that law enforcement. What do you say?
We're here using our constitutional rights. The man who died had every constitutional right. They killed him. They took his gun first. They let their friend clear his body, and then they murdered him.
Well, the protests have remained largely peaceful. Cars coming past, honking horns, trying to show solidarity. A lot of fists raised in the air when they do that. But at the same time, you've had this escalating rhetoric between the Democrat-led city and state authorities here and the Trump administration, particularly doubling down over their account of the killing of Alex Pretty. They have maintained that he was going to carry out, in their view, an armed attack. They published pictures of what they said was his 9mm semi-automatic handgun. And we heard from Greg Bovino, who is this commander at large of the Border Patrol, now a sort of known figurehead on the streets, roaming with his agents. And he has suggested that people shouldn't come out and choose to do what they've been doing when they've been observing and filming these ICE agents here.
I would implore upon any individuals, whether they're anarchists, rioters, or anyone else that thinks it wise to go into a law enforcement scene to disrupt, to delay, is to don't do that.
At the same time, the Homeland Security Secretary, other parts of the administration, seeing what happened here as, in their view, domestic terrorism. Now, all of that has been totally rejected, both by the protesters, the Democrat authorities here, and Alex Preti's family, who call that a lie and say they want the public to understand the truth about him. His dad is Michael Preti.
He cared about people deeply, and he was very upset with what was happening in Minneapolis and throughout the United States with ICE, as millions of other people are upset.
It really feels like a standoff now between this Democrat city and the Trump administration. It represents a much wider story about the battle for contemporary America, a Trump administration that says it's delivering on its elected pledge to carry out a mass deportation campaign, accusing people here of inciting an insurrection, and the protesters and the Democrats here saying that they are seeing their city occupied by agents geared up more for war than carrying out immigration enforcement.
That's our correspondent Tom Bateman on the streets of Minneapolis. Well, I spoke earlier to Charles Homans, who's political correspondent for the New York Times. He is from Minnesota. It's his home state. And he has just spent 10 days in and around Minneapolis covering this story.
You know, it's really remarkable. Minneapolis is a very Democratic city, a very liberal city, which had no great love for Donald Trump, I think, before any of this happened. But it's pretty remarkable the degree to which people are just very unified in opposition to what's happening right now with the federal raids in the city, and feel very personally exposed to them in a way that is just very uncommon in even the, you know, the pretty combustible street politics in this country in recent years.
And how have you seen that manifesting itself on the street?
I mean, in the time that I was sort of traveling around the city, talking to people, I mean, you see a number of different things happening. One is people are just on the lookout for ICE agents all the time, for these federal agents, immigration agents. And there's a real kind of concerted effort organized in these sort of online chats to follow these agents all over and often confront them, which is, you know, clearly something that's led to these very tense and sort of explosive situations in the city. There's also a much kind of quieter, but I think actually larger effort by a lot of people to do things like, you know, help students at elementary schools get rides to and from school if their parents feel like they might be targets of these immigration raids, or delivering food to people who are at home right now because they don't feel like they can go out, you know, because they might get picked up by these agents. Things like that. There's just a real kind of community level mobilization, especially in some of these more kind of left-leaning progressive neighborhoods in the city.
How would you explain to people who don't know the city and don't know the state what President Trump's preoccupation is with Minnesota at the moment? Why is this happening here?
There are a number of things that I think have drawn Trump's attention to Minnesota. The governor is Tim Walz, who is the vice presidential candidate running against him in 2024. And there's certainly no love lost between Trump and Walz after that election. It's also a state that has recently had a genuinely very large fraud scandal involving, you know, the siphoning of upwards of $1 billion from state social services. And a number of the people who have been implicated or indicted in that are members of the Somali diaspora community in Minneapolis, which is the largest Somali diaspora community in the country. So this is something that he has tried to kind of make political, you know, use out of, although very little of this actually has anything to do with the purview of these agencies that have been deployed here. And most of the Somalis in Minnesota are actually U.S. citizens.
Charles, for you, this is one of those moments where your life and your work have come together. You're from Minnesota. How have these last 10 days been for you to be there, to see the changes in your home state?
I mean, it's incredibly surreal to see something like this happen in any place that you know well. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me about Minneapolis is that it is a city that was very divided over the aftermath of George Floyd's killing in 2020, which sort of set off this whole season of these, you know, big protests and rioting in a number of U.S. cities. And that was an experience that I think really divided Minnesotans and people in Minneapolis. But what's kind of remarkable about this moment is that there is very much a sense that people in the city are kind of on the same page in a way they haven't necessarily been in recent years. You know, there's just very little support for these raids in the city. I think it's probably different outside of the city, but there is like a sense of talking to people there that they're really kind of in this together. So it's been very interesting to come back and see that and just this kind of shared sense of purpose in a lot of these communities in the city right now.
Charles Homans, thanks for your time this morning.
It is now 18 minutes past seven. Ryanair, the low-cost airline, says it expects both profits and passenger numbers to rise this year, helped or hindered, well, by a ferocious online row with Elon Musk.
Yeah, well, Michael O'Leary, the chief executive, I think, Nick, as usual, would say every opportunity an opportunity, every argument an opportunity. Yes, you might have seen this big idiot sale that Ryanair have suddenly been running after Mr. Musk and Mr. O'Leary had a falling out, it's fair to say, on social media over whether the Irish airline would incorporate his Starlink satellite system into their planes to have internet on their planes. No mention, I should say, in today's financial results, or not that I could see quickly, of either Mr. Musk or Starlink, but they did flag once again that they hope to overturn a fine that's been imposed by Italian authorities around how they sell tickets online. Alexander Patterson joins us, research analyst specialising in transport for the investment bank Peel Hunt. Alexander, morning.
Good morning.
Is that the kind of headline here then? This fine, we knew a little bit about it, didn't we, and the volume, but Michael O'Leary and the Ryanair team saying they're going to try and overturn it again. This is all to do with whether Ryanair is driving people to their own website rather than allowing other kind of big sellers to sell online, like Kayak and places like that.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so Ryanair wants to make sure that the bookings are on its website. It knows exactly who the passengers are. It has their information so it can update it should flights be delayed for any reason or anything like that. And, you know, it wants to do that. Competing online travel agents would rather they booked with them. And so therefore this dispute has arisen. They've been fined 256 million. They've taken an exceptional charge of 85 million. But I expect that that fine will be overturned by the higher courts in Italy.
Beyond that, projecting growth everywhere and also saying another story we've covered a lot, isn't it, that the backlog of these Boeing aircraft, that they're going to get those sooner to help boost growth this summer.
Yes, that's exactly right. So Boeing has had supply chain difficulties. It's getting on top of those now. So there's only four of the 737 MAX 8 aircraft left to be delivered, and they should arrive by the end of February. And then the 737 MAX 10, which is the bigger version of this aircraft, it competes with Airbus's A321neo. That should start to get certification in the summer and be delivered in the spring of next year. So that's very good news for Ryanair.
If the headwind is not this row with Elon Musk, is it potentially that European authorities are looking at what these airlines call ancillary revenues, i.e. the money they charge for upgrading your seat, booking a bag on, all that kind of stuff?
Yes, the EU has been looking at these, and it would rather that charges for this are included in fares. Now, actually, that isn't great for passengers, because if you like to travel light like I do, then you're going to have to pay extra charges for something that you don't actually want. The other problem with this for the EU is that there isn't room on board. Aircraft aren't built with enough cabin baggage space in order to take a bag for every customer. And so there needs to be some form of additional charging for those who want to carry it in the bag.
Alexander, thanks for your time this morning. Alexander Patterson there from the investment bank Peel Hunt.
Thank you, Will. It's 21 minutes past seven. Israeli forces are searching a cemetery in northern Gaza for the body of the last remaining hostage who is still in the Strip. Last night, the Israeli Prime Minister's office said that the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt would be opened once those remains were found, but only in a limited way. Let's speak to our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, who is in Jerusalem. Yolande, people have waited for a long time for this, but that one remaining hostage who hasn't been returned to Israel, his body, that has been a complicating factor.
Definitely. So just to remind people that in the first stage of the Gaza ceasefire plan, which came into effect back in October, well, that was meant to see all of the Israeli hostages, living and dead, being returned. And the Rafah crossing was supposed to reopen as well, because it's such a key crossing for humanitarian purposes. And Israel remains in control of the Gaza side since it took control of Rafah back in mid-2024. What we have seen with this new statement from the Israeli Prime Minister's office, which came through late last night after a cabinet meeting, is actually a bit of a shift in position. Up to now, Israel's recently, you know, been saying that it won't reopen Rafah until all of the Israeli hostages are returned. You remember, there were a lot of complaints about the slow pace of returning the bodies of the hostages. Now, there's just that one body, Ran Gavili, an Israeli police officer, that's remaining. His family has been saying that the Rafah crossing should not be reopened until his body is returned. There has been an ongoing search operation, but now what we're seeing is that the Israeli Prime Minister's office is saying that once this ongoing search, a new search for Ran Gavili has been conducted, then there'll be this limited reopening of the crossing point, subject to a full Israeli inspection mechanism. That's in addition to the European Union supervisors who are supposed to be there. And there are Israeli media quotes saying, you know, from unnamed US officials, that this crossing will reopen at the end of the week.
And Yoland, you're at the Israeli Supreme Court this morning for a court case which has been delayed many times, brought by the Foreign Press Association to try and compel the Israeli government to let international journalists into Gaza.
Yes, and I'm a member of the Foreign Press Association here, as you might expect. There are hundreds of members based in Israel and in the occupied Palestinian territories. We have been asking as international journalists for unrestricted access to the Gaza Strip. And despite the ceasefire that came into effect late last year, the government told the Foreign Press Association in response to its latest petition earlier this month that it was keeping its ban in place. It's been there for more than 2 years on journalists going in without the Israeli military accompanying them, and citing security reasons for that. Really, you know, that prompted the Foreign Press Association to express profound disappointment. The case is now being heard here at the Supreme Court. We're expecting the hearing to begin any moment now. But we don't know yet. It's not really clear when the Supreme Court will rule on this. Now, it's been said that this is about freedom of speech. It's about the public right to know. What the Israeli Prime Minister said when he spoke to The Economist earlier this month is that Gaza is still a war zone, that it's dangerous. It was put to him, it looked like the government had something to hide because it wasn't allowing international journalists to have this kind of access. That was something that he denied.
It's a case we'll be keeping a close eye on, Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. Thank you.
It's now 25 minutes past seven. One of the most jaw-dropping, stomach-churning videos of the weekend was that of the climber Alex Honnold, who scaled one of the world's largest, tallest buildings without any ropes or harnesses. It only took him an hour and 31 minutes to get right to the top of Taipei 101, using just his bare hands, with his ascent floor by floor, handhold by handhold, filmed and broadcast on Netflix.
He's done it! Alex Honnold has made history again.
Watching, no doubt, was the man known as the French Spider-Man for his many free solo ascents of other skyscrapers. He joins us, Alain Robert, as does Hannah Morris, a YouTuber who creates vlog-style climbing content for a growing audience. Morning to you both.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Ala, you have climbed this building, Taipei 101, although because of bad weather, you rarely decided you'd need some ropes. How did you, what did you make of the climb that you saw yesterday? Any sign of Ala? Oh, no. I'll come to Hannah then. Hannah.
Hi.
you're a climber yourself and you make this content. Was your stomach churning or are you chilled when you see someone climb all those floors?
No, I absolutely wasn't chilled. I told myself ahead of the event that I wasn't going to watch it because I didn't think that my nerves would be able to handle it. But then I did tune in just as he was leaving the ground and, of course, couldn't take my eyes away. So I did end up watching it, but I was right. My nerves couldn't handle it and my stomach was in my mouth the whole time.
Yeah, because there's no trick here. There is nothing holding him up. If he loses a foothold, loses a handhold, he falls off a 101-story building.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's why free soloing as a discipline of climbing is such a controversial discipline within the climbing community, because the consequences are so high.
Just to be clear, free soloing is the jargon for nothing at all. No safety equipment other than a bit of chalk on his belt.
Yeah, so no safety mechanisms to catch you when you fall. So very, very high consequence.
And Netflix just built in a little delay, which is, you know, let's be brutal about it. If he falls off, that gives them time to cut the picture, but it's real.
Yeah. And I think as well, even obviously no one wants to see, should the worst happen, nobody wants to see that. But I think just being witness to kind of like the moments before that happening would be traumatic enough. Definitely a very interesting spectacle for climbing.
But popular. Your YouTube, other sources like this are big content.
Yeah, and I think climbing's really experiencing a boom, and it has been over the last decade or so for a multitude of different reasons. But it's been great to be working in the industry during this time and seeing more people finding climbing and falling in love with the sport.
Well, seeing people like the French Spiderman, who I'm told is now joining us on the line. Morning to you, Alain Robert.
Yeah, morning.
Yeah, you climbed this building. I mean, most buildings you climbed free solo, in other words, without ropes, without harnesses and all the rest. But this particular building, because you were in wet weather, you had to climb with ropes. Are you impressed by what you saw?
Well, I loved it. You know, I was watching it live. I was commenting live for CNN International, and I have absolutely enjoyed it. You know, me on my side, when I did it, unfortunately, in 2004, it was raining cats and dogs. I had 15 stitches on my elbow, and the building was not completely finished. And most of the beam, they were still covered up with some vinyls. And there was oil on the surface. So, you know, there was no way that I could have climbed it free solo at that time.
So what's the tallest building you did without safety equipment?
I've climbed the Petronas, I've climbed the Sears Tower. You know, some of the buildings like Framatome, they are still harder than Taipei 101.
And you often did it without permission, didn't you? Part of the fun for you was you did it when the authorities didn't want you to do it.
Yeah, I've been arrested like, you know, pretty much 170 times. I have been jailed in 70 different countries. And but, you know, I have done also plenty of climbs officially, like the Burj Khalifa in Dubai. I did it twice. I climb as well live on TV in Venezuela, in Montreal.
Just a quick final one, Alain, if I may. I mean this politely, but I think a lot of our listeners will be thinking, what on earth's wrong with you? I mean, what on earth makes you want to climb the outside of a building knowing that one mistake and you are dead, aren't you?
Yeah, but well, that's the way, you know, there is 50 years that I have been climbing free solo on rocks and on buildings. So it's kind of, it's my life. Yeah. It's a life path. It's a lifetime philosophy. And
philosophy, Alain Robert. Know, thank you. That's what makes you the French Spider-Man. That, ladies and gentlemen, is an on-air Gallic shrug about the idea of falling 100 floors from a building. Alain Robert has not fallen, I stress, but he has climbed them. Hannah Morris videos it. Thank you for joining us.
I learned from that you don't even need to be watching it. Just hearing him describe it was enough to make me just feel a bit prickly and uncomfortable. Let's move swiftly on to the sport. Carthy's back, and you've delivered sports broadcasting royalty into the Today studio this morning.
I have indeed. I have not been swayed by Nick Robinson and putting Manchester United as my top story. It is because we have the BBC's football correspondent, John Murray, in the studio with me to talk about Manchester United and Arsenal. John, two wins out of two for the United interim head coach, Michael Carrick. Two impressive wins over the top two sides in the Premier League. A 3-2 win over Arsenal. A first home defeat for Arsenal. Nervy times or nothing to worry about for Arsenal?
Well, I would say as a ruthlessly dispassionate neutral in this that it was a result that the championship race needed, but it was a result that Arsenal did not need. And look, it's not a crisis yet. after what was their first home defeat for nearly 9 months. And also, there was no indication that what was about to unfold was going to happen after half an hour when Arsenal were winning 1-0. It dominated that period of the match. But the fact is, a week past Saturday, they had the chance to go 9 points clear at the top of the table, which would have been the biggest lead that Arsenal have had at the top since they last won the Premier League, which was back in 2004. They didn't take it. Now, that lead is down to 4 points. They've still got to go away to Manchester City in April. They are still the favourites, Arsenal, but, as I said, they've not won the league for 22 years. They've not been in a cup final for 6 years. They've been runners-up the last three seasons. This is new for this group together to try and achieve what they're attempting to do. And they are still chasing success on all fronts, but the pressure is building, as it was always likely to do at some point, and that point is now.
Yeah, very interesting second half of the season, isn't it? And criticism, there was criticism for Ruben Amorim, the previous manager at Manchester United, head coach, sorry, at Manchester United, for not changing his system, which didn't seem to be working with United. What has Michael Carrick done to change all of this?
Well, let's not forget, he is the third Manchester United manager this month. But the start that he had as well to play against Manchester City in the derby and then to have to go away to play against the Premier League leaders, Arsenal, and they've won both matches. I think what's helped is that he is a steady hand. That is what he is. And, you know, he's got that connection with Manchester United as well, having been a player for the club and done great things with them. And also, as he mentioned to us last night, his two sons were in the ground yesterday, 16 and 18 years old. He said they are season ticket holders. They're Manchester United fans. They go to all the matches. You know, that connection does help.
Yeah, and it was one of those kind of throwback top flight matches, two late goals, as you were alluding to earlier, 5 goals in total. You interviewed both managers afterwards. What was their demeanour?
Well, I think Michael Carrick just was what he is, and I think we'll continue to see that. For Arsenal, Mikel Arteta can be tetchy in these kind of situations. Yesterday, he was not that. He was calm, he was very measured, and the message clearly was, don't panic. And listen, middle of last week, they went to Inter, the Italian league leaders, Champions League runners-up last season, played really well and won the match. But, as I say, pressure is on.
Thank you very much, John Murray. In the studio with us, just very exciting for everybody here. A couple of other football headlines for you. The top two sides in the Scottish Premiership, Hearts and Celtic, drew 2-2 yesterday, while Rangers beat Dundee 3-0 to overtake Celtic and move into second place. And over on Five Sports Extra, there's tennis breakfast. The defending Australian Open women's champion Madison Keys has been knocked out of the tournament, and on court at the moment is the reigning Wimbledon champion Jannik Sinner.
I enjoyed that, John. Come back any time. Manchester United
welcome.
Do so well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It doesn't have to be related to Man United, by the way. Just to point that out.
Hello, I'm Greg Jenner, and good news, Your Dead to Me is back for a new series.
Here we go.
Yes, we'll explore Emperor Nero's notorious reign with Professor Mary Beard and Patton Oswalt.
I would not want my daughter having the remote control, let alone an empire.
We'll dissect the decadent life of Philippe Duc d'Orléans with Tom Allen.
I've often tried to pretend I'm an aristocrat and been very quickly knocked down.
And there'll be so much more with comedians like Olga Koch, Mike Wozniak and Ria Lina.
I'm excited.
You're Dead to Me, the comedy podcast that takes history seriously. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
The weather today will be cloudy. There's a band of heavy rain moving into the south and west later in the day. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. And Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
President Trump has indicated that he might at some point withdraw immigration enforcement officials from Minneapolis as outrage grows over the fatal shooting of a nurse by federal agents on Saturday. Mr. Trump also said that his administration was reviewing everything connected to the shooting. The former presidents, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, have both issued statements calling on Americans to stand up and defend their values. Labour's decision to ban the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, from standing in an upcoming by-election has been openly criticised by some of the party's backbenchers. Mr. Burnham says he's disappointed and he criticised the way Labour is run. The Mayor is seen as a potential leadership rival to Sir Keir Starmer if he becomes an MP. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has promised to make police respond quicker to 999 calls. Under new plans, forces in England and Wales will be required to respond to emergency calls within 15 minutes in urban areas and within 20 minutes in rural areas. It's part of a wider overhaul of policing, which will be outlined this afternoon. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has written to head teachers in England saying that all schools should be mobile phone free. In a letter to schools, seen exclusively by the BBC, she said that it was not appropriate for phones to be used as calculators or for research during lessons or during break times. Ofsted will inspect schools on the implementation of their mobile phone policies. Gold prices have hit a record high, above $5,000 an ounce. Investors turn to the precious metal during times of economic uncertainty as it's seen as a safer asset. And the UK is to back new offshore wind projects in the North Sea alongside nine other European countries. For the first time, some of the new wind farms will be linked to several nations through undersea cables, which supporters say should lower prices across the region. However, wind farm operators would be able to shop around between countries to sell the power to the highest bidder, potentially driving up electricity prices when supply is tight.
Thank you, Charles. It's 23 minutes to 8 o'clock now. Was Keir Starmer's decision to block Andy Burnham's bid to return to Parliament as Labour's candidate in the forthcoming by-election in Manchester's Gorton and Denton constituency ruthless, divisive, but necessary? Or a sign of weakness, factionalism and another nail in his coffin? It is fair to say that opinion in the party is, how should we put it, divided. Nadia Whittam joins us in the studio. She's Labour MP for Nottingham East, was very critical last night of this decision. And she's joined by Harriet Harman, who's seen a few rows in her time. Former leader of the House of Commons, former deputy leader of the Labour Party, now Baroness Harman, and sits in the House of Lords. Morning to you both.
Morning.
Nadia, first of all, your reaction?
Well, there'll be different views about this in the party, and I have enormous respect for Harriet and I'm always interested to hear what she has to say about things. But myself and many other Labour MPs from right across the party, and you've seen that on social media, believe that in blocking our only senior Labour politician with a net positivity, a net positive popularity rating, who is the Mayor of Greater Manchester, is putting petty factional manoeuvring and settling personal scores above winning elections, and in doing so is risking gifting the seat to Reform. Only 8% of people in Greater Manchester polled agree with the decision to block Andy Burnham.
Last night you went further. You said the last person at Labour HQ had better turn the lights off on their way out. Do you not understand their rationale that says he was elected as mayor? He's only served a year and a half as mayor. He should just get on with his job.
That's, like, let's be honest, that's not the reason that he was blocked, is it? Only 8% of people in Greater Manchester agree that he should have been blocked.
What was the reason?
If members in Gorton and Denton didn't want to select Andy Burnham as their candidate, then They wouldn't have to. It should be a free choice for members. It's not for me to say. It's not for anyone else to say. It's certainly not for a small part of the NEC, not even the whole NEC, to deny members that choice.
Do you think that now this judgment should still be reconsidered? There is a letter circulating amongst backbenchers that says the whole of the National Executive Committee should now deal with what in the letter is called a remote stitch up from a very small group of people at the very top in London.
I think that would be the fairest outcome for people at the top of the party to say, look, we hold our hands up, we got it wrong, we can see the psychodrama that this has caused, and we'll take this back to the whole of the NEC and look at the decision again.
Let's bring in Baroness Harman. Psychodrama this has caused, she says. You understand how these sorts of decisions are taken. Why do you think they risk this row?
Well, I think the default position is that if you're a mayor, you can't run for Parliament, and that's why the process is that you have to make an application. And I think that once Andy had made that application, and I'm slightly baffled as to why he did when it could or should have been clear to him that it would end up like it is now, which is him not being able to run.
Just pause there if you would, Baroness Harman. You think it's obvious when he applied he was bound to be blocked?
Well, I think he could have found out, because what was going to be obvious is that the NEC would support the position taken by the party leader, Keir Starmer, which they did by 8-1. So I think that it would have been better if he found out first whether or not the way was going to be cleared for him to run. And if it was going to end up the way it has now with him not able to run, well, it would have been better for him to not put in an application. But I think the task for Keir Starmer now is to bring the party together in the light of this and actually, you know, win back the support of people like Nadia and many in the party. And above all, I think to get on with doing what he does want to be doing, which is sorting out the problems in the country, because that's what people in the country want. So I think people in the party want there to be unity, and people in the country want there to be focus on their problems.
Well, people in the party don't just want unity. Many of them, not all, but many of them want him gone. They've concluded that Keir Starmer is a loser, that the poll ratings cannot be recovered, and they think Andy Burnham is more popular, more charismatic, and frankly more left-wing, and they want him instead.
But I think that shows that the leadership instability and the challenges to the leadership are actually a symptom of the cause. They're not the cause of the problem. And the cause of the problem is the worry and concern that people are not feeling they can look to the government as being on their side, and the change they want to see happening is not happening yet. So the task for Keir Starmer in the light of this is to do what he's doing, which is focus on improving lives of people in this country. But he's also got a job to do as a result of this leadership challenge from Andy Burnham,
Nadia,
to bring the party together.
You were nodding along at what you think the party wanted, nodding along as Baroness Harman spelt it out. If that's what they try to do now, we've got the Scottish Secretary Douglas Alexander coming on the programme about half an hour's time. Will you go, well, fair enough, we lost that battle, but we'll continue to fight the war? Or are you determined that come what may, you will find a way of getting Andy Burnham into Parliament? And let's be honest, get him to challenge Keir Starmer for the leadership, because that's what this is about, isn't it?
Well, this is a point about democracy, and it's a point about winning an election and not risking, not just gifting a seat to Reform, but potentially even coming third, like we did in Caerphilly.
But you might do that in the Greater Manchester by-election that there would have to be if he stopped being mayor, mind it. You might win one election and lose the next one.
Look, I'm not going to be drawn into questions about leadership today, but what a lot of backbench MPs feel is that our loyalty is to the Labour Party, not to some of the people at the top of the Labour Party who are wrecking the party that we love and what is currently the only electoral vehicle to prevent a Reform-led government in 2029. The stakes are so high.
To be clear, you think Keir Starmer doing what he's doing, Keir Starmer staying in office, he is the one who is risking Reform reaching power?
Well, I think ultimately the responsibility lies with the leader.
Nadia Whittam, Labour MP for Nottingham East, Baroness Harriet Arm, thank you for joining us.
16 minutes to 8 now. Here on the programme, we've been marking the National Year of Reading, which is happening throughout 2026, focused on getting more people of all ages to read for pleasure. And we've been very lucky because some of our most cherished writers have been sharing the book that for them ignited or reignited their love of reading. And today it is the turn of Mallory Blackman, author of the Noughts and Crosses series of novels. And she has chosen The Silver Chair by C.S. Lewis, volume 6 of the Chronicles of Narnia series, published in 1953 by Geoffrey Bless.
I've always been a reader and I've always loved books, but I think the one book in particular that ignited my love of reading and made me want to devour every book in my public library was The Silver Chair. It's by C.S. Lewis and it's one of the Narnia stories. What resonated with me in particular is the way that the heroes of the story, the protagonists, Jill and Eustace Scrub, They didn't succeed all the time. In fact, they failed constantly, but they still kept trying. And when they went into the underworld and they confronted the witch who was holding Prince Rillian a captive, she was trying to persuade them that her reality was the only reality and her lies were the only truth. And that really resonated to me and spoke to me, and it still does. You see that lamp? It is round and yellow and gives light to the whole room, and hangeth, moreover, from the roof. Now that thing which we call the sun is like the lamp, only far greater and brighter. It giveth light to the whole overworld, and hangeth in the sky. Hangeth from what, my lord? Asked the witch. And then, while they were all still thinking how to answer her, she added, with another of her soft silver laughs, you see, when you try to think out clearly what this sun must be, you cannot tell me. You can only tell me that it is like the lamp. Your sun is a dream, and there is nothing in that dream that is not copied from the lamp. The lamp is the real thing. The sun is but a tale, a children's story. Yes, I see now, said Jill in a heavy, hopeless tone. It must be so. It still speaks to me. It's really strange how things you read as a child can still resonate and still kind of stick in your memory. And we're living in times where it seems like those who shout the hardest or have money or have power or have influence can try and persuade us that, you know, that the sky isn't blue on a summer's day or whatever. That this particular passage just pops in my head. And so there's something about this that's always stayed with me, and this idea of hold on to what you believe to be the truth, even when everybody else around you is telling you it's not. And it stuck with me, and it kind of, I think it helped to sort of, it helped to grow my stubborn streak, which has served me well over the years, I think. I think reading is not just, you know, it's not just a pastime or something to do to have fun or whatever. It's so crucial. Reading for pleasure opens so many doors, and it allows you to explore the world from the comfort of a book, and it allows you to explore it at your own pace. It allows you to embrace new concepts and new ideas. And whoever says, I don't like reading, I always say to you, you haven't found the right books for you yet, because believe me, they are out there.
That was Mallory Blackman, and it is 12 minutes to 8. My little hesitation there was because it's normally thought for the day at this time. We have found the bishop. We haven't yet quite found the studio and the line, but we'll bring him to you very, very soon.
In the meantime, at, as you were saying, 12 minutes to 8, let's talk about social class. Well, the idea that, well, question really, would making social class a legally protected characteristic like race or religion, for example, would that help more people from working class backgrounds get jobs in the arts? One group in Manchester who've looked into this think that yes, it would. Nazir Afzal is with us, Chancellor of Manchester University, chair of the Lowry Theatre, and is chairing the Glass Ceiling. It's a review of working class participation in the arts across Greater Manchester. And James Graham is here in the studio, award-winning playwright, screenwriter, who focuses on working class characters in some of his stage and screen work and has talked about this topic before. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
James, first of all, I find this a really fascinating topic, and it's just because it's so complex. How do you define social class? Does it change through your life? Does it, you know, I suppose it does change your access to the arts when you're young. How do you describe it, James?
I get really squeamish talking about it. I'm a proud identifier of someone who came from a working class background. I'm one of the, I think it's only 8% of people in the arts or the media who defines themselves as working class, even though well over a third of the UK sees themselves that way.
What is it about your background that defines you as working class?
Yeah, really good question. There's different metrics, but generally speaking, people say it's based on what your parents' occupation were around the age of 11 or 12, and of course it could also be your education. So my bona fides are, you know, mum worked in a warehouse, stepdad window cleaner, that was my first job, comprehensive school in Nottinghamshire. But you're right. I mean, people consider it to be a fluid characteristic in the way that you would never lose your blackness or your gayness, or you wouldn't become less Muslim the better you do in the arts. But I feel like people, the eyebrow gets raised when I say I'm from a working class background, because people frankly just don't believe you. And often it's about the stories that you're allowed to tell. I've been fascinated about power and politics. I've written plays set in Westminster in the media. So one of the important things about this report, which I commend, is what stories are we allowed to tell about ourselves? I don't want to be exclusively defined by my economic, socioeconomic background. I want to be able to tell anything.
What was your gateway into the arts? And I ask that as a former comprehensive school child.
It's a different
way in. Did you go and see a play? Was there something that happened at school? You know, what was it that opened that up as a career opportunity for you?
as this report identifies, it's, as a former prime minister once said, education, education, education. It's so important. And the last decade has been pretty devastating in terms of the loss of arts from comprehensive school education. It's been completely diminished because of the EBAC, and this, the Labour government has said they will reverse that policy and put arts back at the centre of schools. I was just incredibly lucky. The reason why I'm a playwright who gets to do shows on Broadway and sit in the Today Studio programme is because of my drama teacher. It was a very socially, economically deprived area, former mining town, and there was just a philosophy in the school that said working class kids should do plays, put on plays, go and see shows. And it changed my life. It opened me up to a world of imagination, expression, confidence, empathy, all of these superpowers that art gives you. And you know, so I feel so passionately about it that in my last West End play, it was a story called Punch, set on a social housing estate in Nottingham. I couldn't bear the idea that it would be an audience full of largely middle class people who I was grateful for their support, and we want to tell these stories across the social spectrum, but that though the people we were representing wouldn't be able to get into the building. So the only way we could do that is to defer profits. The producers and myself didn't make any royalties, and we invested that back in, and I got to get a coachload of kids from my school in Nottingham down to the West End, the first time they'd ever seen a show in London. I feel very moved by that. So it is, and it, why is it important? Because a country is only the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, and if a significant number of those people don't get access to those worlds or get to tell their story back to the world, then we are diminished as a society.
Yeah. Nazir, as we said, you've been looking into this, and as James so powerfully explained there, there are many barriers, social, financial. Which ones did you identify in particular?
All of them. James is absolutely right. Britain doesn't have a talent problem. It has a system that quietly filters talent out. So class, income, geography, access, these are all the things that stop people from being in the room. And if you're not in the room, your story doesn't get told. And what we learned during the inquiry was that more than half of people with working class backgrounds were differentially treated because of their social class. Less than half earn enough for it to be their only job. Less than one in five now say their lived experience isn't represented in the arts. Only one in five knew someone growing up that was in the industry. And as James quite rightly pointed out, it starts in school. Fewer kids are taking arts and music GCSEs. We spoke to teachers who were furious at rising truancy and exclusion rates because they felt children were being denied creative avenues. Creators themselves were struggling to make a living and having to work three jobs in some cases. Art students spoke about being mocked at university for being poor and over being discriminated against. And promoters, music was one of the really worst areas, actually, because musicians told us the anger they were felt at being exploited by people who, and writers also told us about how they were being treated with disdain by commissioners. It was across the board. The evidence is clear that this is a structural problem, and that's why we feel that class shouldn't be treated as an awkward afterthought. It's rarely measured, rarely published, almost never targeted directly. What we need to do is to ensure that class is treated exactly the same way as all the other nine protected characteristics. And, you know, that requires legislation, but we can't do that just right now.
Yeah.
And the former, you know, son of a toolmaker needs to have a look at it. But at the same time, what we can do in Greater Manchester and other regions can do is to treat class in the same way that they treat all the other protected characteristics.
Nazir Afzal and James Graham, thank you so much for joining us.
At 7:55, a little bit later than usual, it is time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the Bishop of Manchester, the Right Reverend Dr. David Walker. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning, Nick, and everybody. We finally made contact. Is bigger automatically better? Is small always beautiful? Later today, we're expecting the formal announcement of a much-leaked government plan to radically restructure policing, a plan that would see both fewer forces in England and Wales and more aspects of police work taken to a national level. I'll leave the merits of the proposals for politicians and pundits to discuss elsewhere. My point is that conversations about the right sizing of organisations are ones that we need to have, and the answer won't always be the same. One of the new developments we've launched in Manchester in recent years is Fabric Church. It's close to the city centre, and just over 2 years since it opened, has over 200 people, mostly younger adults and families, attending each week. Yet we've also set up our Antioch network of small, hyper-local churches. Each serves a single estate or specific inner-city community. If they reach around 60 adults, we ask them to split and keep growing. All large organisations face the challenge of balancing economies of scale with local accountability. But for me, there are theological factors to lay alongside the political and pragmatic. At the heart of Christianity lies relationship. Our faith asserts that every one of us can know and be known by Jesus Christ. So what does that mean for both large and small bodies within and beyond the churches? I'm currently working as chair of a new housing association, one we set up to embody the key findings from a recent church report, starting with just a handful of properties we want to grow. It's the only way we can make a meaningful impact, but without losing our vision or compromising our values. Not least, we want to make sure that we keep close to our tenants so that we know them, not just the statistics on a spreadsheet, and they know us. At the very opposite end of the spectrum, next month I'll be travelling to the Philippines for a conference bringing together senior figures from across the worldwide Anglican Communion. The cultural and religious contexts of our national and regional member churches differ widely. We don't agree about everything, and nor should we. But we can ensure that there are key leaders in our churches from whose warm and friendly relationships will come shared plans for future mission. Keeping relationships right at the centre seems to be, to me, where sound theology and good business practice come together. Hold on to that, and I believe, big or little, global or local, the bodies we build can be both better and more beautiful.
That was Thought for the Day with the Bishop of Manchester, Dr. David Walker.
Have you got the fibre factor?
The recommendations are that we eat 30 grams of fibre a day. 96% of us are not meeting that.
I'm Hugh Fernley Whittingstall, and I'm getting fired up about fibre.
Whole foods are not just physically important, they're mentally important, they're socially important, they're culturally important.
I want to find out just what fibre can do for us.
You can hear it bubbling. That is the sound of deliciousness.
The Fibre Factor, with me, Hugh Fernley Whittingstall. Every afternoon this week at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Let's check the weather. Helen Willits is back. Morning again.
Hello, Anna. We don't really need any more wind and rain, do we? But there is unfortunately more in the forecast, and for many as well, which means that those areas that have been affected recently by flooding and the strong winds are likely to see another dose. Today, it's relatively quiet ahead of that. For England and Wales, the rain gets in here through the afternoon to Wales and southwest England, but elsewhere ahead of it, it's just really rather cloudy, grey and misty and murky. It's a lot of low cloud and a few drizzly showers around. It's relatively mild at about 8 to 10 degrees Celsius in the south, 7 or 8 in the north. The wind's picking up with that rain in the west, and we'll notice that even earlier across Northern Ireland. It's already just approaching the western side here, so turning wetter progressively through the afternoon and windier as well. Temperatures around about 7 or 8 degrees. For Scotland, well, it's a relatively mild start. We might see some brightness in the northwest here, but there are showers in eastern areas, wintry over the Grampians and the southern uplands, and then the rain gets into the west this evening, but not really much further until tomorrow. Whereas elsewhere overnight, we get another pulse of rain coming on, this potent low that I talked about, and with it, widespread gales, even severe gale force winds around the Irish Sea coast. So, really unsettled picture ahead of us through tonight and tomorrow.
Helen, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 26th of January. The headlines this morning: the Prime Minister is facing a backlash from some Labour MPs, angered by the decision to block the Greater Manchester Mayor, Andy Burnham, from attempting to return to Westminster, and a potential leadership challenge. We'll speak to the Scottish Secretary, who will speak on behalf of the government this morning at 10 past eight. President Trump has promised a thorough review of the fatal shooting of a protester by immigration agents in Minneapolis, the second such killing this month. More protests have been taking place overnight. We'll be hearing from local politicians about the impact on the community.
The killing of our resident by ICE has put Minneapolis into a crisis mode. Renee Good and Alex should be alive today.
And the Home Secretary is promising faster responses to emergency calls as part of a wider shake-up of policing in England and Wales.
And coming up in this hour of the programme, Hugh Bonneville will be here in the studio with us as he takes to the West End stage as C.S. Lewis in the play Shadowlands. And where are the most beautiful stained glass windows in the country? We'll speak to the woman whose book has inspired that search. Before all of that, the BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
The decision by Labour's ruling body to stop the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, from standing in an upcoming by-election has angered some of the party's MPs. They say he would have been the best candidate for the Gorton and Denton seat, and barring him is an own goal, which made the Prime Minister look weak. Mr Burnham, who's seen as a potential leadership rival to Sir Keir Starmer, said that he was disappointed by the decision and concerned about the potential impact on important elections ahead. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
The most catastrophic mistake is how one Labour MP described the decision by Sir Keir Starmer to vote to block Andy Burnham, adding that disgruntled backbenchers hope to try to put pressure on Labour's leadership to rethink. Sir Keir was one of the members of the ruling NEC panel who voted 8-1 to stop Mr Burnham standing. Their argument, if he won the Westminster seat, he'd have to stand down as mayor, leading to an expensive election for that post, which should be avoided. In response, Mr Burnham posted on social media that he was concerned the decision might harm Labour's chances in the by-election, and he complained that the media had been told before he had, saying, "Tells you everything about the way the Labour Party is being run these days." Labour sources said they had called him, but he hadn't answered.
The Labour MP for Nottingham East, Nadia Whittam, told us many of her colleagues were feeling let down.
What a lot of backbench MPs feel is that our loyalty is to the Labour Party, not to some of the people at the top of the Labour Party who are wrecking the party that we love and what is currently the only electoral vehicle to prevent a reform-led government in 2029.
The former Deputy Labour leader Baroness Harman said Mr Burnham could have avoided the row.
What was going to be obvious is that the NEC would support the position taken by the party leader Keir Starmer, which they did by 8-1. So I think that it would have been better if he found out first whether or not the way was going to be cleared for him to run. And if it was going to end up the way it has now with him not able to run, well, it would have been better for him to not put in an application.
President Trump says his administration is reviewing everything connected to the fatal shooting of a US citizen in Minneapolis by federal immigration agents, the second this month. There are growing calls from within Mr. Trump's Republican Party for a full investigation into the killing of 37-year-old Alex Preti. The former presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton have both issued statements calling on Americans to stand up and defend their values. More protests have been taking place in Minneapolis against the Immigration Enforcement Agency, known as ICE. Our correspondent Tom Bateman is there.
Protesters are vowing to stay on the streets of Minneapolis until the ICE agents leave, deepening the rift with the Trump administration, while the president is demanding the city and state's Democrat authorities hand over immigrants with criminal convictions and without permission to be in the United States. However, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Trump struck a slightly more conciliatory tone over the killing of Alex Preti, twice declining to say that the border agent who killed him had acted appropriately, instead stressing that the administration was reviewing the incident. Amid signs he could be looking for a political way through the crisis, public opinion polling may be weighing on the White House, with some research suggesting a growing minority of Trump voters see the ICE raids as too aggressive in nature.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has pledged to get more police out of offices and onto the streets as part of her overhaul of policing in England and Wales. Forces will have to respond faster to emergency calls under the plans, which will be published this afternoon. Officers will have to reach the scene of the most serious incidents within 15 minutes in cities and 20 minutes in rural areas, and be expected to answer 999 calls within 10 seconds. Gavin Stevens, who chairs the National Police Chiefs Council, told us that advances in technology would help cut response times.
If you're a victim of domestic abuse or coercive and controlling behaviour, you might want a video chat call with a specialist within a few minutes. Or if you're involved in a serious collision on a motorway, we may be able to get a drone up to see the situation first to know what resources to get there. The last big reform of policing was done in the early 1960s when policing didn't even have access to a pocket calculator. And now, of course, we live in a world of deepfakes and cybercrime. The world is changing and we have to keep up.
Israel has said that it will reopen the key crossing point between Gaza and Egypt only after an operation to retrieve the body of the last remaining hostage in the territory is complete. A new search has begun for the remains. The Israeli Prime Minister's office said that the Rafah crossing would open only for pedestrians, not for goods. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
The Rafah border crossing was meant to have opened during the first stage of the Gaza ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, and all remaining Israeli hostages, alive and dead, were supposed to have been handed over. The US and other mediators are continuing to press both sides to take the next steps to advance the peace plan. Two envoys for President Trump met the Israeli Prime Minister on Saturday ahead of his cabinet meeting. The Prime Minister's office later said that Israel would open the Rafah crossing upon completion of the new search for the body of the last remaining hostage, policeman Ran Gavili, without giving details on how long that would be. Local reports quote Israeli military officials saying they've begun a new operation in a cemetery in northern Gaza and that it could take days to complete.
The price of gold has surged to a record high, above $5,000 an ounce. It's seen as a safer asset for investors during times of economic uncertainty. 2 years ago, the price of gold was just above $2,000 an ounce. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has written to headteachers in England saying that all schools should be mobile phone free. Her letter, seen by BBC News, says phones shouldn't be used in lessons, including for research or as calculators, or outside them during breaks. The General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, Pepe D'Asio, supports Ms. Phillipson's statement.
This gives absolute clarity. It takes away any ambiguity and in some respects is something that's great for parents, but most importantly will help young people understand how important it is to not be so reliant on their phone, to have their phone out of the way and out of reach during school times.
The UK and nine other European countries are joining forces to back a new generation of wind farms in the North Sea, capable of generating enough electricity to power tens of millions of British homes. For the first time, the wind farms would be connected directly to more than one country by undersea cables. The idea is that the power will be directed to whoever needs it most, smoothing out spikes in demand and reducing prices. Bowel cancer screening in England is to be brought into line with Scotland and Wales in order to catch more cases earlier. The NHS says that many more lives could be saved as a result. Frances Reid has the details.
It's the UK's fourth most common cancer and the second biggest cause of deaths from the disease in England. Now, the at-home screening tests used to detect early signs of bowel cancer will have thresholds lowered for follow-up tests to be carried out. The home testing kit's already offered to everyone over the age of 50, but this will see the number of people going for further colonoscopies rise by a third. The changes could cut late-stage diagnoses and deaths from bowel cancer by 6% and save the NHS around £32 million a year. They'll be brought in gradually so that services can meet demand. While it brings England into line with Scotland and Wales, the threshold for further tests will remain the same in Northern Ireland.
New research has found that spider monkeys possess a sophisticated social system, sharing insider knowledge about the best fruit trees in the forest. Scientists discovered the primates constantly change their foraging groups, allowing them to exchange vital information about food sources. Helena Burke has the details.
Researchers from universities in Edinburgh and Mexico spent 7 years studying the behaviour of black-handed spider monkeys in the Yucatan Peninsula. They observed that the large groups the primates live in split into smaller subgroups when searching for food. Different combinations of monkeys would split off each time, meaning the same subgroup might never forage together twice. Dr. Matthew Silk from the University of Edinburgh says these groups are a clever way of sharing knowledge about the locations of the best fruit trees. Some parts of the forest were known by many monkeys, like a town's favourite restaurant, while others were known by just one or two, like a hidden gem.
And that was Helena Burke.
Charles, thank you. It's now 8:10. Who should decide who represents the people of Gorton and Denton in Parliament? Voters in that part of Manchester? Local party members, perhaps? Or Keir Starmer? The Prime Minister is a busy man. But yesterday, on a Sunday morning, just days before he heads off to China for a very important trip, the Prime Minister found time to attend a meeting of the officers of Labour's National Executive Committee, which blocked the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham's bid to run in that by-election. Critics say it's a stitch-up to save Starmer's skin. His allies insist it was a necessary, if ruthless, decision to prevent months of political bloodletting. This is what Nadia Whittam,
Labour MP for Nottingham East, said to us earlier in the programme.
What a lot of backbench MPs feel is that our loyalty is to the Labour Party, not to some of the people at the top of the Labour Party who are wrecking the party that we love and what is currently the only electoral vehicle to prevent a reform-led government in 2029. The stakes are so high.
To be clear, you think Keir Starmer doing what he's doing, Keir Starmer staying in office, he is the one who is risking reform reaching power.
Well, I think ultimately the responsibility lies with the leader.
We'll speak to Douglas Alexander in just a second. First, though, our political editor, Chris Mason, making it clear, though not exactly spelling it out in words of one syllable there, Nadia Whittam, wasn't she? This is about the future leadership of the Labour Party, and many people want Starmer out and Burnham in.
Precisely that. Morning to you, Nick. And therefore, a calculation taken by Downing Street that better a storm now than Andy Burnham making the political weather for days and weeks and months ahead. And yes, it is true, as Downing Street have been articulating, that a by-election with him as a candidate would have been a circus. I would have been sourcing some Denton digs and moving in to follow every twist and turn, because it would have been utterly unconventional as a contest, with a very prominent candidate being asked every day about his plans for the highest of offices. And so, yeah, that is exactly where we find ourselves. And the reason we find ourselves in this situation, Nick, is, yes, because of Andy Burnham and his ambitions, but crucially, because of the vulnerability of the Prime Minister. If the Prime Minister was flying high, the return of Andy Burnham would be newsworthy and interesting, but less so.
Chris, for now, thank you. We'll talk to you again after we've had a word with Douglas Alexander, who may forgive me, may not, for calling him a veteran campaigner, worked with Tony Blair and Gordon Brown in government, came back to Parliament and is now Scottish Secretary masterminding Labour's campaign in those crucial Scottish elections coming up this May. Douglas Alexander, good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. You're no spring chicken yourself.
Well, thank you. Yes, we can share the compliments. Well, you'll understand the reference in this joke, given your age. What first attracted Keir Starmer to the idea of blocking the more popular, more charismatic Andy Burnham from returning to Parliament and challenging him in a leadership election?
Okay, so let's start our interview with me saying something that you probably weren't expecting, which is Nadia is right in that the stakes are very high in the coming months. We've got electoral contests right across the country. I'm heavily involved, as you acknowledged, in Scotland. We've got colleagues fighting in Wales and in local councils right across England. Given Andrew Quinn's resignation, there will also now be a by-election in Gorton and Denton. We can't do anything about that. And so yesterday, the officers of the National Executive Committee had to try and weigh a challenging judgment. They had to weigh, first of all, the particular rules in relation to whether a sitting mayor or a police and crime commissioner can stand in a parliamentary by-election. They had to weigh the Labour Party's general sense as to whether it was in the Labour Party's interest to have what would be otherwise an unnecessary contest in Manchester. That's about the size of 20 parliamentary by-elections happening at once. And as your commentary before this interview suggested, the risk that the contest would absorb time, energy and money when we absolutely need to be focused on a series of opponents who literally want to tear our country apart.
Well, I can hear the rationale. I just want to understand, if I can, the principle involved here. Is it the case that the Labour Party believes that the selection of Labour candidates should be made by local party members in every election?
OK, so let's take this from first principles. What was decided yesterday was in relation to the specific rules, if you want to know, Chapter 5, Clause 4, Subsection 2 of the Labour Party rulebook, in relation to the ability of a sitting mayor to put themselves forward to be a candidate. It has been in the Labour Party rulebook for many, many years that the National Executive Committee has a clear view and responsibility in relation to parliamentary by-elections, because they have a consequence far beyond the individual constituency.
Sure, but those words but are used also about local party membership to elect their candidates for every election. Just forgive me, I'll just get to the end of the thought. They're from Keir Starmer. It was Keir Starmer himself said in a tweet, of course he wasn't at the time, Prime Minister and leader of the Labour Party, the selections for Labour candidates need to be more democratic, he said. We should end NEC imposition.
But Nick,
of
that's not the gotcha question you think it is, because what was decided yesterday was specifically in relation to a sitting mayor. We will now proceed as a Labour Party, it will be a judgment for the National Executive Committee, as to the selection for local members in Gorton and Denton. But in that sense, it's not an analogy that I would draw. But I think in relation...
Well, other than local party members will not get to choose, will they? They will be prevented from choosing Andy Burnham.
Well, it depends on the shortlist that is subsequently drawn up. But the specific decision that was taken yesterday by the officers was in relation to the particular clause that was overwhelmingly endorsed by the Labour Party conference a few years ago, which said there have to be exceptional rules in relation to both sitting police and crime commissioners.
Understood.
And also sitting mayors who are holding office at the time.
And yet you chose your words carefully. You talked about the National Executive Committee, or at least the officers of it, weighing what you called a challenging judgment. Are you saying that at a different time, in different circumstances, it might be that the National Executive Committee says to Andy Burnham that he can run for Parliament?
Well, I need a little humility in this. I don't often compare myself to Elizabeth I, but I don't have a window into men's souls. And in that sense, let's see for the future. But the specific point on Andy is this. Let me come to the specific point on Andy. The judgment that was made yesterday, you're right, was in relation to the particular circumstances of today. I can attest to the fact that Andy's been out of Westminster for 9 years. I was out of Westminster for 9 years and then was re-elected in July 2024. I would certainly hope that Andy would want to continue to serve in the UK Parliament once his term is made as finished. I have to declare a bias here. I'm both a friend and a huge admirer of Andy Burnham. I think he's got an immense amount to contribute, not just in Manchester, where he's doing a brilliant job, but I would hope to Parliament in the future. But the judgment the NEC made yesterday was, you're right to recognise, in relation to the particular circumstances where in 101 days we have hugely consequential elections.
Yes, but
in
that's
Scotland,
where I'm puzzled,
in Wales,
you say.
And in
sure.
the rest of the
Forgive
UK.
Me interrupting you, but you made that point in your first answer. And what I'm trying to get clear here is whether there's a principle at all. Because at one stage you said there's a rule. Well, if it's a rule, what on earth does the Prime Minister have to go to a meeting on a Sunday morning when he's a very busy man? The rule's the rule. You just say you can't do it. But no, you're saying there's a political judgment there to weigh it. It was very challenging.
There's no contradiction there. The rule is that if you're a sitting mayor, you have to seek the permission of the National Executive Committee.
And they may give that permission in future
circumstances. The National Executive Committee then have to make a judgment as to the basis on what's the best interests of the Labour Party. Let's just have
a thought. But that may be different in the future. Just sort of
yes, yeah, absolutely.
That could be different.
Absolutely, it could. Because let's just do a thought experiment for a second, Nick. If the decision had gone the other way yesterday, there is an alternative world in which the officers of the NEC had green-lighted the equivalent of 20 parliamentary by-elections, diverting time, energy and money to the Manchester mayoral contest. We would have fought hard, but yep. There would have been huge jeopardy there. Reform are outspending us at the moment, 10 to 1. And in the biggest and most unnecessary electoral contest in England, that undoubtedly is not a risk-free choice. And I think that helps explain the decision that the National Executive Committee also made.
There's a bit of a habit here, isn't there, from the top of the Labour Party? You're not all that keen on democracy at the moment, are you? You don't want to have this contest potentially for the future leadership of the Labour Party. You don't want Greater Manchester to have a by-election. You've just cancelled 29 council elections in England. It's not all that democratic, is it?
Well, listen, I think it was Tony Blair who said to decide is to divide. The reality is we would be being criticised as a government if we'd allowed a whole lot of contests going ahead, notwithstanding the local government reorganisation that is happening across England. And in that sense, I think that does stand apart from and is separate from an internal judgment by the National Executive Committee as to how to best advance the interests of the Labour Party
Come
over the next 101 days.
It's not an internal judgment from the National Executive Committee. It's a decision of the leader of the Labour Party who wants to hold on to his job and got his allies.
So let's be candid with each other, Nick. Of course, there's a legal argument, and I've set that out. But there's also a political point here. What does our constitution say as a democratic socialist party? By the strength of our common endeavour, we achieve more than we achieve alone. We exist as a Labour Party, not for what's best for an individual, but what's best collectively. And the coming months should be about confronting the forces in British politics that want to tear our country apart. and offer instead a vision of the Labour Party's future, which is about us pulling together. So, of course, there is politics involved in the judgment that the National Executive Committee makes, because, frankly, we have the fight of our lives on our hands in relation to reform. And that psychodrama that we could have anticipated, I understand if the National Union of Journalists was an affiliated union and had been in the room yesterday, they would probably have voted to put Andy forward. Because it would have been a dripping roast of stories for them. But the job of the National Executive Committee is to decide what's the best interests of the Labour Party as we face these very considerable electoral challenges.
But you see, what Nadia Whittam, who you said you agreed with at the beginning of this interview, the Labour backbenchers, who she'd be quite surprised, I suspect you're quite surprised to find yourselves in agreement, she thinks Keir Starmer is putting his personal future ahead of his party's and ahead of the country's. And as you know, many of the critics who want to see Keir Starmer gone, not because they don't like him, not because they have an animus with him, but that they are terrified that Nigel Farage will be the next Prime Minister of this country, and they think that is almost guaranteed if Keir Starmer remains in office.
So listen, it's not a great reveal that Nadia has never been Keir Starmer's greatest supporter, but the substantive point, which is, do we take profoundly seriously the threat of reform? Absolutely. Because, frankly, they represent an approach to British politics the like of which we haven't seen and which deserves and must be confronted. I think you've got to ask yourself, as the National Executive Committee asked themselves yesterday, where is the best interest of the Labour Party served? And would our opponents have been cheering every one of those 101 days if the Labour Party had decided to engage in a psychodrama over the coming weeks about who's in, who's out, who's up, who's down in Westminster, instead of directing our fire and training our sights on reform, on the Greens, on the Scottish National Party and Clyde Cymru? We have the electoral fight of our lives on our hands. We have to throw every effort at our external opponents. And I think that helps explain the basis on which the officers reached the decision yesterday.
Douglas Alexander, I'm not sure what you just did to deserve to be the person defending this decision this morning, but we're grateful that you did. The Secretary of State for Scotland there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us from Westminster. Still with us, Chris Mason, our political editor. Well, he set out very clearly the rationale. Take the pain now, Chris, to avoid it going on for week after week for those of you in the National Union of Journalists.
Indeed so, Nick. Yeah, Douglas Alexander gets the call for an appointment with you and others when the wicket is a tad sticky and perhaps others are rather less keen on heading out. And he was acknowledging there, wasn't he, the reality of the politics of this, that at the root cause of this is the lack of popularity for the Prime Minister, deeply unpopular, and Labour as well, hence confronting these elections that Mr. Alexander kept looping back to that are so, so perilous for Labour. Couple of quick thoughts. One, Andy Burnham saying on social media relatively late last night, floating the prospect that Labour could lose this by-election. Local campaigners in Greater Manchester saying that the seat is a microcosm of the previous Labour voter coalition. There's urban Manchester there, but there is Tameside, which might lean towards reform. So that in itself will be fascinating. Where does this leave Keir Starmer if Labour were to lose that by-election? And what of Andy Burnham's long-term future? It was pointed out to me last night that quite a lot of the NEC, the National Executive Committee, from which those officers on that team's call yesterday morning made that judgment, are up for election this summer. So how that body might change, were this scenario to repeat itself at some point in the future, is a live question for some.
And briefly, if you would, Chris, pretty clear that Douglas Alexander was saying this was not once and for all. This was a decision in these circumstances at this time. So Burnham might have a go straight after those May elections.
Quite. Is there another opportunity where he could have another go? They're leaving the door open. They're also trying, Nick, to ensure they put a fire blanket on all of this as quickly as they can, that they don't provoke Andy Burnham any further. He is clearly angered and bruised, and they calm those Labour MPs, also irritated by the machinations of the last 24 hours or so.
Chris Mason, our political editor, thank you.
It is just coming round to 25 past eight.
Our streets! Our streets! Our streets! That is the sound of large protests in the US city of Minneapolis, despite temperatures as low as minus 25 Celsius. People were out on the streets again after the shooting dead of another US citizen by ICE agents sent by Donald Trump to remove illegal immigrants. 37-year-old Alex Pretty was an intensive care nurse. He was on the street that night documenting the raids. Now, the Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, said that Pretty was shot on Saturday because, in her words, he was brandishing a gun. Local authorities have denied this. They say that that gun was legally registered and that he was shot after the gun was removed. Well, Tim Walz is the Democratic governor of Minnesota, and he has repeated his calls for the US president to remove federal immigration agents from the city.
I don't care if you are conservative and you are flying a Donald Trump flag, you're a libertarian, don't tread on me, you're a democratic socialist of America. This is an inflection point, America. If we cannot all agree that the smearing of an American citizen and besmirching everything they stood for and asking us not to believe what we saw, I don't know what else to tell you.
The Minneapolis city authorities have called for an investigation into the death. Donald Trump has said overnight that that would happen. I've been speaking to Jamal Osman. He's the vice president of the Democrat-controlled Minneapolis City Council. He is the first Somali American to hold that post. And I asked him about what this crisis is doing to the city.
It's been really difficult for last few weeks for city Minneapolis. The killing of our resident by ICE has put Minneapolis into a crisis mode. You know, Renee Good and Alex should be alive today. I think these were neighbors, they were our community members. And losing innocent people has been very difficult for so many residents in Minneapolis. And we're tired of watching, you know, families lose their loved ones. So it's been really difficult, and folks have been protesting peacefully and exercising their rights.
What kind of conversations have you or have the council been able to have with the administration, with ICE, to try and solve some of the problems here?
None. Ever since they came, they're not communicating with us. They're not talking to our chief of police. They're not talking to our mayor or talking to any local government. They are coming to the communities. They are creating chaos, panic. They are detaining U.S. citizens. They're stopping people because how they look or how they speak. They even detain Native American residents, which is shocking. These are the people that their land was stolen, and now they have to carry their tribal ID with them all the time. And ICE has been acting above the law, and the folks that are here, close to 3,000 armed of ICE, are not trained, they're not professional, they are just killing people and treating people horribly in their city.
The Trump administration, through their press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, has said that the governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz, is in part responsible for this. They say that he wants chaos in Minnesota, that he's encouraging left-wing agitators, these are the words of Caroline Leavitt, to stalk and record federal officers in the middle of lawful operations. They say that's placing them in extremely dangerous situations. What is your response to that?
It's absolutely garbage. It's absolutely rubbish what he's saying. Our governor has been very clear and calling peace. Our mayor has been calling peace. We were all calling peace. And all we're asking is for them to work with us. We understand they are in the state, but the lawlessness they're acting doesn't make sense. And their explanation doesn't live up with the videos that we're seeing. It's that simple. If you look at the footage, and anybody look at the footage, then what everyone is seeing is very clear, but the official version doesn't match the reality, and there's no trust there. And of course, you know, not the state, local government to have an opportunity to investigate and look at the evidence of the scene. They were kicked out. We were told you're not part of it, and we believe the federal government are jumping to the conclusion, really calling out the victim families and horrible names and saying they are terrorists, and it just doesn't really make sense. And I don't think they are being, we believe they will be destroying the evidence and trying to hide what's happening.
There's clearly a lot of tension and a lot of very bad feeling going on the streets. Jamal, what do you think needs to be
or could be the first thing that could be done to try and calm some of that, to try and solve some of these issues?
Yeah, I just think that, you know, we need to get away from politics. This is not about politics. This is about human beings. This is about the residents that are being killed. You know, ICE are bringing trauma to our neighbors and our neighborhoods. But we're united. We're going to continue protesting and peacefully, and we want accountability. And I believe what ICE need to do, they need to get out of our city. They are not making any safe for anyone. And now they're acting lawlessness. And this is a sign of collapsing empire or collapsing government. And we're just hopeful that the Congress, and not just the state of Minnesota, but all the 51 states, can all come together and stop this. Because they will be next.
Jamal Osman, thanks for your time this morning.
It's just after 8:30. Now, if you're an Arsenal fan, look away now, because Carthy has the news on sport.
Yep, starting with that Manchester United win. Two matches in charge for Michael Carrick as caretaker boss. Two wins over the top two sides in the Premier League, Manchester City, and last night, a 3-2 victory over Arsenal, which means Arsenal's lead at the top of the table is down to 4 points, while United are now in fourth place. The top two sides in the Scottish Premiership, Hearts and Celtic, drew 2-2 yesterday, while Rangers beat Dundee 3-0 to overtake Celtic, and they are now in second place. So all of the weekend's results are on the BBC Sport website. It is now week two of tennis's Australian Open. Novak Djokovic is aiming to win his 25th Grand Slam title at the age of 38, but the world number one, Carlos Alcaraz, and the reigning Australian Open and Wimbledon champion Jannik Sinner have claimed the last 8 Grand Slam titles between them on the men's side. I've been talking to the 7-time Grand Slam champion Mats Wilander, who won 3 Australian Open titles and is part of the TNT Sports and Discovery Plus team, about why it's called the Happy Slam. But I started by asking who he sees coming through the women's draw to lift the first major trophy of the season this weekend.
Oh, Aryna Sabalenka, pretty much by far, because she played an amazing match against Victoria Mboko. It's the best I've ever seen a woman play tennis, to be honest. Iga Swiatek is getting by. She's winning, but maybe not as clean. And then Elena Rybakina is playing well, so she's dangerous. Of course, Coco Gauff is winning, but maybe not playing that great. But Sabalenka, clear favourite.
And our listeners might not know the name Iva Jovic, the 18-year-old from America who's tearing through the field now into the last 8. What's so impressive about the Jovic game?
First of all, she moves amazingly well. She is into the corners and out of the corners with great balance. She has a great forehand with quite a lot of topspin, which is a little bit unusual on the women's tour. She reads the game incredibly well, and then mentally she seems to be in a really, really good place. So I expect huge things from Iva Jovic. I think she's on her way to the top 10 within a year or two.
On the men's side, Jannik Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz have won the last 8 Grand Slams between them. Carlos Alcaraz, there's a career Grand Slam on the cards here. You mentioned to me on this programme last year that Alcaraz needs a bit of time to get into the season, but do you think he's in a different place at the start of this season, perhaps?
I think so. I really do. He seems to be playing really well. He's made some really good tactical decisions here in a couple of matches. First of all, it tells me that he's doing well without Juan Carlos Ferrero in his corner. He's making a lot of decisions, I think, on his own, which I think is great for the development and the future of his game. I mean, because of Jannik Sinner's match the other day, you would have to say that Alcaraz looks a little bit better than Sinner. But then again, Sinner on a cool day is most probably a more dangerous player than anybody else.
Yeah, we saw Sinner cramping and struggling with the temperatures when they were almost 40 degrees. And you do need a bit of luck, which Sinner had that day when the roof came on, so play stopped for a little while. A bit of luck for Novak Djokovic, his fourth round opponent, has withdrawn with an injury. When you're trying to win Grand Slam number 25, that's a pretty helpful bit of luck right now for someone of that age, isn't it?
Yes, it's absolutely a lot of luck for Novak Djokovic. And I think Jakub Menšík, who he was supposed to play, is also a really dangerous player. So for Novak, it's perfect. He's played enough tennis and enough matches here. I'm putting Novak in the same place that he was last year, and maybe even better, because I think he knows this year that these guys are on a different level and he needs to come up with maybe something that he's never done before. So I think Novak is more dangerous this year than he was last year.
At the age of 38. And just finally, Mats, the Australian Open is a very creative Grand Slam. It started with the 1-point slam competition. We've had 100,000 people through the gates on several days in week one. Some concerns perhaps there that it's overcrowded, but can you give us a flavour of what this Grand Slam is like in 2026?
Well, it's like a festival, to be honest. I think out of the 100,000 people that come here, half of the people don't see one shot in tennis. They come here to have a couple of beers and listen to some music and watch the big screens. But it's very difficult to get into the outside courts. It's obviously impossible to get into the big courts unless you have a ticket. So it's a little bit too crowded for my liking, to be honest. But then again, the atmosphere is incredible, especially when the Aussies are still in the tournament. Roger Federer once called it the Happy Slam. And I think because it's the summer here and it's winter in most of the world, people are just happy to be here. And I think players are the same and they're fresh as well. They come in maybe with less confidence, but physically they're very fresh.
Well, enjoy week two of the Happy Slam. Mats Wilander, thank you very much for joining us.
Karthik, pleasure, pleasure.
And you can watch every match at the Australian Open live on TNT Sports and Discovery Plus. There's also commentary on Tennis Breakfast on Five Sports Extra. And in the last few hours, a defending women's champion, Madison Keys, has been beaten by fellow American Jessica Pegula. The reigning men's champion, Jannik Sinner, is on court right now and he has a two-set lead over fellow Italian Luciano Dardari.
Thank you, Carthy. It is 24 minutes to nine. Start the week is on the way at 9 o'clock and Adam Rutherford is here to tell us about it. Morning.
Morning, Anna. So dread it, run from it. Artificial intelligence is here all the same. And by the gods, there's a lot of nonsense spouted about it. So we're cutting through some of that noise to ask, what is intelligence, artificial or natural, and how it emerges from networks of computer chips or from the meaty matter in our highly evolved skulls. So we're also asking what AI can do with evolution in the age of synthetic biology. Will it rewrite 4 billion years of genetic code? Will we create new species? Hubris much? Well, just to deflate the hype, we've got a brilliant comic novel about just how far AI is from replacing us, told via the medium of a board game without rules. It's absurdist and satirical and very, very funny. So it's AI, genetics, neuroscience and philosophy with lols. Always intelligent, never artificial. Come and play. Start the week at nine.
Heady mix. Thank you, Adam.
Quick look at the weather. Today, cloudy. A band of heavy rain will move into the south and west later in the day.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster, and Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer is facing a backlash from Labour MPs angered by the decision to prevent the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham from standing in a by-election for a parliamentary seat. Mr Burnham is seen as a potential leadership rival if he becomes an MP. The Scottish Secretary, Douglas Alexander, told us that allowing Mr Burnham to run would have created a psychodrama and an unnecessary by-election for a new Mayor of Greater Manchester. President Trump has indicated that he might at some point withdraw immigration enforcement officials from Minneapolis as outrage grows over the fatal shooting of a nurse by federal agents on Saturday. Mr. Trump also said that his administration was reviewing everything connected to the shooting. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, is promising to make police respond quicker to emergency calls. Under new plans, forces in England and Wales will be required to respond within 15 minutes in urban areas and within 20 minutes in rural areas. And the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has written to head teachers in England saying that all schools should be mobile phone free during lessons and at breaks. Her letter calls on parents to back the policy.
Thank you, Charles. Let's talk a little bit more about that, shall we? The entirety of the school day is what she says, as Charles was saying there, the school environment should be so not used as calculators, not used to do research for different topics. Daniel Kerbedy is with us, General Secretary of the National Education Union. Morning.
Good morning.
And also Paul Howard Jones, who's a Professor of Neuroscience and Education at the University of Bristol, who believes that smartphones should be allowed in schools. Morning to you, Paul.
Morning. Morning. Good morning.
Daniel, first of all, at the moment, schools do their own thing on this, but most of them, I mean, there's not many that I'm aware of that are actively embracing kids pulling out their phones during lessons.
That's right. So schools have had to deal with mobile phones for many years. I mean, I can remember them having to deal with mobile phones when I was a teenager over 20 years ago. So it's something schools are well versed in. They do often have very comprehensive policies in place. But I do think that schools are demanding more support with this, but they were preferring legislative support or indeed actually, action on social media and algorithmic content, which is the real problem impacting young people at the moment.
What difference would legislative support on this actually make? What practical difference?
Well, you know, at the moment, school policies can end up meaning that they're ending up in conflict with parents or indeed young people about how to enforce these. So, putting this on a statutory footing would be welcome. You know, I lead a trade union and I find myself often in agreement with the Conservatives on this issue at the moment. There's a real crisis around mobile phone use and child mental health.
Paul, you take a slightly different view of this. Why is it that you think that smartphones are not a problem for teenagers at school or elsewhere?
Well, I mean, to be clear, I think smartphones are an issue for teenagers. It is a problem, but it's a matter of how to tackle it. And I don't necessarily think demonising the technology is the way to do it. It's all about how the technology is being used. So I'm glad that this is not statutory, this idea that they should be banned completely from schools. So that at least those schools who feel they have the capacity to allow children to use phones at points during the day can have a policy that allows that. Excuse me, whether we're talking about smartphones or brick phones. Because, I mean, it's attractive, this idea of, we could turn back time, and I can understand why schools would want to do this. They can be a real nuisance, these phones. But actually, it's an important life skill to be able to regulate phone use. And one thing that an outright ban would do would be to kind of shift that responsibility more towards the home and towards parents. And I think the other thing is, I would not expect too much in terms of improved learning and improved well-being from an outright ban, because the research I'm quoting a review from 18 months ago on this, showed little or no conclusive evidence that a one-size-fits-all phone ban in schools results in improved academic outcomes, mental health and well-being.
Yeah.
So it's not straightforward.
I think one of the key questions, Paul, is, and, as a parent of teenagers, and I think any parent of teenagers will be hanging on whatever you have to say next, how do you teach a child, a teenager, to self-regulate with a phone? Because from everything I'm seeing, it is really, really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think having periods when phones are not allowed out, meal times and such other times, perhaps when doing homework, but also having conversations with children about how they're using their phones, because, I mean, there comes a point when we have to know how to use these devices. They're incredibly important learning tools. I learn so much from my phone. So digital hygiene is what I call it, being able to use technology in a healthy way is really important. And obviously schools have a role in that. But if we're saying that these phones should never be brought out at any point in the school day, then that kind of shifts. I mean, as soon as they get home, they're going to get their phones out, aren't they? So it's not really going to
catch up on a day's worth of scrolling. Daniel, one of the biggest problems that I think parents find is peer pressure.
Yeah.
Because if there's one group of friends mm-hmm. who are on the phone, who are messaging, who are arranging something, and you're saying, right, it's dinner time, give me your phone, that's when the problem, that's when you can see the really emotional reaction to the phone being taken away.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's incredibly difficult for parents at the moment. I am a parent, and I completely understand how problematic it is trying to be that individual parent trying to manage that situation. That's why I actually think we need whole-scale legislation on mobile phones, particularly around algorithmic, addictive social media content. It should be banned for under 16s. We regulate tobacco, we regulate alcohol. We should be regulating this highly addictive technology that even adults struggle with regulating. Mm. I can lose a couple of hours doom scrolling in a day, and we're expecting children to be able to manage.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about this much more. I'm sure we are. Daniel Kebbedy and Paul Howard-Jones, thank you for joining us.
Time now is 17 minutes to nine. Choose your favourite stained glass window. That's what you're being invited to do by the Association of English Cathedrals. Competition that they set up, having read a book called Divine Light, The Stained Glass of England's Cathedral by the architectural historian and church heritage expert Janet Gough, who joins us on the line. Morning to you, Janet.
Good morning, Nick.
You obviously love them, these stained glass windows. What's the magic?
Well, what's the magic? And it's interesting you say I love these stained glass windows. I must give credit to the head of collections at Canterbury Cathedral, who just said
Janet, you've got to share the glories of these amazing buildings. And I've been on a bit of a voyage of discovery, and they are amazing. So what's incredible about them? Well, they're not just in the famous cathedrals, not just in sort of Canterbury and York, but they're across all of our cathedrals. And they span 900 years, and we're still using old techniques, traditional techniques, but with some modern twists, and we're still commissioning them. But I suppose the thing that identify them is colour. So if you look at those very early narrative windows in Canterbury Cathedral, the bright colours are still as bright today, whereas, sadly, say, wall paintings fade. They're very good. I mentioned the word narrative. They're a fantastic medium for telling stories.
And the sense that they have survived so much as well, isn't it?
Yes. Sorry, say that again.
The sense that they've survived so much of our history, survived the Reformation, survived the Revolution, survived the bombing attacks on many of our cities.
Yes. No, that's incredible. I think we have much more medieval glass than I certainly realise. You know, the narrative was that everything went out in the Reformation. But no, we hang on to it. And it's interesting, one of the 12, because 12, what the Association of English Cathedrals have done is they put all of them on social media, one every day, and people liked them, and they chose the 12 most liked. Anyway, one of those is the Tree of Jesse, which sits really high up above the high altar at Wells Cathedral. And I'm sure it survived because the Puritans couldn't reach it, so they couldn't damage it.
Yeah, the joy is the list. I won't give you the whole list, but there's Carlisle and Chester and Ely and Gloucester and Newcastle, Sheffield. So if you think it is just the big names of those cathedrals, it isn't. And you can go online and see them. Have you, you may not reveal it to us, but have you already chosen your winner?
Well, that's very interesting. Of course, I would say this, wouldn't I? I love them all. But I just want to highlight three you haven't mentioned. And they're all three at the end of the Middle Ages. And they are Gloucester Cathedral's Great West Window that used to be called the Cressy Window, because, of course, it was done at the height of the Hundred Years' War when Edward the Third was sort of in, everything was going wonderfully. And he's got these tiers of knights and then kings and then saints and Mary and Jesus. And I call it Stairway.
You shouldn't rush ancient history, but I'm going to have to rush you through your other two, if that's
all right.
Okay.
My other two are then a terrible period, 50 years later, of, you know, a rebellion and schism. And yet they produce at York Minster this absolute sheer spectacle in 117 panels.
Gloucester, York, and finally?
And finally, I love the Great East Window at St George's Chapel, Windsor, which in addition to having popes and kings, also has a wonderful master mason with his hammer. And we think it probably was the person who built the window and the great vault.
Janet Goff, thank you very much indeed. The book's called Divine Light. The competition, there are other options available, 12 in all, and is by the Association of English Cathedrals.
It is 13 minutes to nine. Now, C.S. Lewis was a master of creating magical worlds. Who can forget the extraordinary creation that was Narnia, the chronicles about it still beloved to this day. And now a play that is newly in London's West End called Shadowlands looks instead at the author's own world, the deep love that he experienced through his relationship with the American poet Joy Davidman and the pain of eventually losing her to cancer. Well, the part of C.S. Lewis in the play is played by the acclaimed actor Hugh Bonneville, who joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us is Frank Cottrell Boyce, the children's laureate and aficionado of C.S. Lewis. Frank, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hugh, it's interesting, isn't it? Because he is one of those authors whose created world we know in such intimate detail, but actually people know far less about his own life and what was happening behind the scenes for him.
Well, this particular play is a snapshot of an era later in his life when he was living in Oxford as a pipe-smoking, beer-drinking don who hung out with Tolkien and lived with his brother in a rather dusty house on the outskirts of Oxford and was living a very peaceful academic life. And into that world erupted this fizz of energy, Joy Davidman, who'd been in correspondence with and turned his life upside down in a good way. And he fell in love and married her. And then she, as you say, she contracted a terminal illness. And so the play really is about analysing the notion of love in a world of suffering, which obviously is a big, you know, question at the heart of the Christian faith, of which he was a great devotee.
What drew you to it as a part?
Well, I think I'd seen it or read it years and years ago, and then there was a wonderful. Originally, it was a television play starring Joss Ackland. Then it was a very successful stage play with Nigel Hawthorne and Jane Apatow. Then a movie with Tony Hopkins and Deborah Winger, and it's been revived every so often. I did it about 8 years, 6 years ago at Chichester Theatre, and so this is our chance now to reimagine it in the West End. But it's hard to describe a play about suffering as being funny, but it is. It's a tremendous analysis of late flowering love and this balance of really having to have the pain if you're going to have the love. It's a very moving play, but we've had a lot of fun, you know, putting it together, and we bring it to the stage at the Albridge next week.
You've talked a little bit about how your own recent experience of bereavement and grief has, I mean, how do you bring that to a character? Do you need to separate the two things out? How does it work for you, Zanat?
Well, I mean, none of us are immune from what's at the heart of this play, which is the notion of loss and suffering. Yes, and I lost both my parents and a brother in recent years. And, of course, that colours your appreciation of life, apart from anything else. And the notion of it coming to an end and how you face that, which we all have to, whether we like it or not. So it does inform the way you think about performing a role like this. But I think it's really there in the writing that the pleasure of life has to be balanced by all the, you know, the suffering that we can go through. I mean, I think bereavement is a strange thing, as anyone who's been through it knows. It's like strange waves upon a shore. Someone once described it to me. Sometimes the wave can crash in and knock you over when you have a memory of someone you love. And the next day, that, you know, the wave will ripple and tickle around your feet and make you laugh. So it's a strange thing, grief. And in fact, C.S. Lewis wrote, after Joy died, he wrote an anonymous short book called A Grief Observed, and published it anonymously. And in fact, several people then sent it to him saying, Jack, you might want to read this because I think it reflects your state of mind. And eventually he came clean. And I think it was only posthumously that it was published with his own name on it. But it's a very interesting and passionate account of his own experience. And I think one of the ones that really sticks out to me, one of the lines in it, is about how he didn't expect grief to feel so like fear. It can be a very strange and discombobulating experience. And there are many stages, as we all know, anger and disbelief and as I say, fear and fear of forgetting someone, I think. But this play is really about cherishing memory at the very end.
Yeah. And Frank, I think it's, you know, interesting to hear you say that because any writer, any author, you inevitably will seek to find a way to channel those feelings into the written word.
Yeah, I mean, I think all art is an attempt to kind of rescue something from the torrent of time and save it. And that's, I mean, particularly, I think, Grief Observed, which he wrote so quietly, as you said, straight afterwards, it really captures that process of trying to hang on to something, knowing that you've absolutely lost it. He talks about the tiny heartbreaking commonplace. You know, it's not just the big seas and the big skies, it's the tiny heartbreaking commonplace. It's an amazing book. I think it's his masterpiece. Mm.
Do you think that we read things like The Chronicles of Narnia differently when we know more about the author?
Yeah, I mean, this is the second time Lewis has been on the Today Show today,
it
which is
is
a great
an
testament
hour ago.
To his power. And earlier on, you had Mallory Blackman talking about the Silver Chair, and she picked out this moment when the children are underground with this wicked queen who's trying to convince them that the sun isn't real, that the upper world and the beautiful world isn't real. It's just this dingy downstairs thing that she's got. And she's lit a fire with kind of perfumes and drugs in it. And it's this amazing moment. That's the one that Mallory Blackman picked out this morning. And their companion, Puddleglum, saves them by stamping on the fire and burning his own foot. And that idea that pulses through this play and through all of Lewis's work, that suffering is revelation, that you suffer for someone else, and in your weakness and in your ability to be hurt is where you find the truth. So he stamps on that fire and they suddenly remember the sun and Narnia and brightness and loveliness. And that I think that's the whole of his work in a nutshell, really.
Yeah, I know.
And
a lot of people.
It's definitely there. It's really strongly phrased in this play, I think. Yeah. You know, that part of the entertainment of this play is just how amazing Joy is. She's so kind of perfectly named. She called herself bookish, she was bookish, over precocious and arrogant. She's like, you just really want to be in the room with her. You know?
It's that extraordinary contrast, isn't it? Thank you so much, both Frank Cottrell-Boyce and Hugh Bonneville. The play opens next week.
From the 5th of February at the Albridge in London.
Great to have you back on the West End stage. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It has, actually, yes. I'm looking forward to it very much.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming here. Now, let us turn to drama of a different sort. Psychodrama is the word endlessly being used to describe what has been going on in the Labour Party, or what, that is, Keir Starmer may have prevented by blocking Andy Burnham from becoming the candidate in the forthcoming Gorton and Denton by-election. To examine that, to explore it, we're joined by Patrick Maguire, chief political commentator for The Times and the new Labour whisperer, the man people turn to know what's going on behind the scenes. And here in the studio with us, Tom Baldwin, former Labour Party senior advisor and a biographer of none other than Sir Keir Starmer himself. Morning to you both.
Morning. Good morning.
Patrick, let's begin with you. In your column today, you describe quite graphically quite how angry Labour Party members and members of Parliament are with this decision.
Yes, indeed. Look, the Prime Minister looks weak because his position in the Labour Party is weak, and he had a choice between several different expressions of weakness. Now, he didn't have any good options, but what he has done and what the people around him have done is chosen a course of action that vindicates a very popular criticism of his style of leadership, which is that he is surrounded by people who are very good at organising within the Labour Party, but like doing these sort of zero-sum steamroller vetoes of anybody vaguely to their left. And I think that is a big part of why there will be a backlash to this. It is not necessarily about Andy Burnham. It is about the way the Labour Party is being run.
A backlash that will get any momentum? Because I'm struck this morning, there is no big beast coming out, Patrick Maguire, to complain about this.
I think it is a more insidious thing, a more pernicious thing. You know, I think what the Labour leadership did yesterday was that they created another moment of jeopardy for Keir Starmer. And in February or in March, whenever the by-election comes, there will be a massive explosion of discontent as people look forward to the local elections in May. And they say, hang on, if we are coming third behind the Greens and Reform in what was hitherto a safe Labour seat, and Keir Starmer and Morgan McSweeney threw that away to preserve their own position, which is how lots of people will see it. I know there's a separate argument against about a Manchester by-election for the mayoralty.
Let's put that to Tom Baldwin now, if we could. That's the calculation that people think has been made. Forget losing a by-election to Nigel Farage's party because we're saving Keir Starmer's skin. Right? Wrong?
Look, I think, Patrick points out, there's jeopardy all around, and the prospect of a by-election for the mayoralty of Manchester, 20 times the size of an individual parliamentary constituency, was, I think, bothering quite a lot of people actually from that region themselves. The idea of losing one of Britain's great cities, as you know, Nick, was horrific. To the idea of losing that to Reform and what they might have done, the administration of Manchester, I think, did concentrate some minds yesterday.
Do you think it was ever in any doubt? Or frankly, was it obvious Keir Starmer was going to block Andy Burnham? And frankly, was it obvious to Andy Burnham he was likely to be blocked?
Yeah, well, they object to the word block because, in fact, the agency was Andy Burnham. He was seeking special permission to go round the presumption that serving mayors don't stand for Parliament. So, you know...
The reality's the same, though, isn't it?
Members who
want him to be the candidate will not get the chance to vote for him to be the candidate, and voters won't get the chance to vote for him either.
Yeah, but this is less than one third of the way through Parliament. You've got a Prime Minister with 160 seat working majority, 3.5 years before next general election, grappling with towering challenges at home and abroad. And I know this sort of Westminster soap opera obsesses people like you, me and Patrick.
Yes, I'm glad you said you, because you did it for a living for a very, very long time.
I'm fascinated by it. I'll just humbly say, respectfully say, that sort of who's up, who's down, is he going to stand, is he not going to stand, is utterly irrelevant to the real needs and real concerns of most people living in this country.
But, Patrick, is this merely a leadership crisis postponed?
I think it is. And the reason there is I wouldn't necessarily a leadership crisis, but the reason there are questions about Keir Starmer's leadership is because people in the Labour Party keep asking them because they don't think he's doing a good enough job and they don't like the way his team runs the party.
So
and
there will be, with only seconds left, Patrick, you think there will be a leadership election at some time in the months to come?
Someone will try and trigger one, yes.
And that, Tom Baldwin, is what Keir Starmer frankly knows and is preparing for, isn't it?
I think what he's done is prevented months and months of speculation about will he, won't he, will Andy Burnham launch a leadership bid now? You know, and he wants to get back to governing, grappling with these towering challenges at home and abroad. Maybe people will push him away from that. Maybe he'll be distracted from that by